Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 238. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, James Jones.
There's no ladies listening to this.
John Lindemann.
Back again for the people.
And Greg
what
Leahy.
People?
Ahoy, ahoy,
who
everyone.
Demanded this? I sure as hell didn't.
Thank you for tuning in. We are excited to deliver another great episode to you today. We've got, of course, new business with an interesting mix of new and old material, I think. And, of course, now playing and your listener mail coming up later. And we'll have a little update on Retroactive as well. But the actual discussion of Retroactive for the Legend of the Mystical Ninja will be next week. So we wanted to give us and you a little more time to play the game. All right, it's time for new business. James, what you got?
So Xbox Live Arcade has been having one of their deal. I guess it was a weekend. They had a bunch of stuff on sale, and then there was, of course, a Major Nelson video that went through and discussed all the stuff that was on sale, which I pretty much always just ignore. But for whatever reason, I had a lot of time to kill that day, so I watched it.
The Crazy Larry?
Yeah.
Yeah, I watched it.
It is at least better than the ones that we have on the Nintendo channel.
It's bad, but at least they do sales.
Yes. So one of the games that came up on the bottom of the screen, the little ticker, was Afterburner Climax.
What a terrible name.
I was going to say, which I expect John to make comment on right about now.
It's like, I suppose it was came down to like that, and Afterburner Thrust was probably the other option they had, apparently.
I would have actually preferred if it were Afterburner Thrust. I think that would have been much more exciting.
Afterburner Lift would also work.
Johnny's breaking out the engineering here.
I went to school for that. James, you must have been a fighter pilot in another life.
I enjoy that kind of game. I just, you know, for me, that's my action game. It's because usually there's lots of shit going down on screen. There's a certain amount of twitch reflex involved in it. And I feel like you can get better at them.
Is it better than Hawks 2?
God, what isn't? But I set the standard for this game a lot lower, too, because it's an arcade game.
Mm-hmm. Would you pay, like, $5 for it?
Somewhere in the 5 to 6 range.
Yeah, whatever that is.
That was on sale. I don't remember how much I paid for it. But I guess it's a port of the original Afterburner arcade game, which is one of Yu Suzuki's first arcade games. You've probably seen it or one of its many inspired sequels in an arcade at some point if you grew up in the early 90s.
And it was immortalized in T2 in the arcade.
Oh,
scene,
it yeah. was, wasn't it?
Afterburner was a huge game in the arcades when it first came out.
It was big.
Yeah, it was a huge game.
Well, yeah, I remember this was the big machine that cost $1 to play, which was a lot
yes.
in the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, I remember I almost shit my pants when I saw that Mortal Kombat 2 was 75 cents a game.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I think that is ridiculous.
This was very controversial among my friends and I. Because, you know, if it was this big, like Afterburner was this big thing with a seat that you got into and it kind of moved and it had rumble. You know, you could kind of understand paying a premium for that. But Mortal Kombat 2 is a game with a joystick and buttons.
Yep.
Like 75 cents.
Yeah, and that's kind of the Yu Suzuki MO for his early arcade games. Because remember, he had the his first game, I think, was the motorcycle game. You actually sat on a motorcycle, and that yeah. was the controller.
It was Hang-On, right?
Yeah.
Was he involved with Space Harrier?
I do not know. I should know that, but I don't.
Sega was, you know, very arcade-focused in the late 80s. They did a lot of these big cabinets, because their thought was trying to get away from basic stuff and make it more like an experience. I know he did Outrun, he did Hang-On, he did Afterburner, he did Daytona. Yeah.
And then eventually Virtual Fighter, which is the ultimate gimmick eye-catching arcade
oh, yeah.
game.
Yeah, Space Harrier was also Yu Suzuki, by the way.
Okay.
I think technically he's still at Sega, but I don't know what the hell he's working on these days.
Anyway, Afterburner is this game where you're a fighter pilot and shit's just coming at you like crazy. And basically, you don't have a lot of maneuvering. It's like a Star Fox game. You're going straight forward, only you're going straight forward at breakneck pace, and the whole screen wants to make you die. Afterburner Climax is just an HD upgrade of the same game. So if you actually go out and read reviews, people will talk about, like, when we were sitting in the office playing this game, people were over my shoulder reciting the terrible dialogue alongside it. Because it's the same dialogue, it's just as terrible as it was as I remember. The voice acting is incredibly awful.
I guess the question is the game actually fun enough that you want to play it without the big chair that you climb into that moves around? And...
So I didn't play the original Afterburner. That was a little bit before my time. That was 87. But I played a lot of one of its subsequent kind of sequels, G-Lock. Mm-hmm. I might have actually played Afterburner at some point, but I played a lot of G-Lock.
Pretty sure there's an Afterburner 2.
Yeah, there was.
Which I think that's probably the one I played.
Yeah, it's really, really awesome. But without Deceit, it definitely loses something. But what I found is that the game itself is kind of hard, but as you do stuff, you unlock the ability to tweak the game settings. Like, you can give yourself more continues, more lives. You can make your plane go faster, because that's exactly what you need when you're trying not to plow into walls. You can just do all kinds of crazy shit to the game. And I actually spent probably about 5 or 6 hours just playing this game over the course of a couple days. Just sort of enjoying it for what it was. Just a relatively simple but still enjoyable action game.
Now, it is one of those games that it's perfect for the 3D upgrade. I mean, that actually would make the game better, because I guarantee if you went back and played the original game now, you would be like, wow,
it looks awful.
This is awful.
I've played G-Lock, and G-Lock's many years younger. I played that recently, and it's awful. I mean, like, explosions are just like... Actually, it's the same sprite from the shots from Space Harrier. The yellow ball shot?
Yeah, yep.
It's the explosions are just a trail of those. So it looks really, really good. It's a really pretty game, and there's just shit going down everywhere. There are missiles flying all over the place, explosions, tons of enemies to shoot out of the sky. The game loses a lot in not moving, but the visual assault that it wages is enough to kind of make up for it.
Does it have like different like score attack modes?
There's a score attack mode. There's a couple of routes you can take. There's a few optional stuff, things you can do in the flight path. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's a pretty straightforward game. It's enjoyable. It's not great, but it was a fun little throwback title to eat a few hours of my weekend.
Yeah.
Well, what else ate up your weekend?
So I bought, because I have a 3DS and there's not that many games I own yet, I bought Ridge Racer. Ridge Racer.
3D.
3D, yes, because every game system launch has to have a Ridge Racer.
This is one of the if I bought a 3DS right now, this is probably one of the two games I would get.
I knew the game was better than your average Ridge Racer. I had already been told that explicitly, but it's kind of hard to believe it. Like, you're just like, sure, it's a great Ridge Racer game. Yeah, fuck you. In fact, I played the game at E3, and my impressions, because I'm the only person who wrote impressions for it, because I'm probably the only one who played it, basically say, well, it's Ridge Racer, but it's actually kind of fun.
Well, hang on. When was the last time you played a Ridge Racer?
I played a Ridge Racer on the PS3 at somebody else's house. I played the DS Ridge Racer, which is awful. I played one of the N64 Ridge Racers. Might have only been one. I can't remember.
There's only one on the 64, and that's the only one that I've ever played.
Yeah, I mean, they have their own kind of mostly arcadey, but little bit simish feel to them. They're not a kart racer.
Right.
They're closer to Project Gotham than the other Microsoft Racing series.
I'd say a little bit like San Francisco Rush, although the controls are better.
Yeah, San Francisco Rush is kind of just careening around and hoping.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't really feel like you're controlling a car so much as a missile with little... fins on either side.
No, it's a missile with a bunch of neon underkit lights.
Yeah.
So what I'm surprised about, though, is the amount of content in this game. There is a ton of events which are broken up into races.
Are there more than 3 tracks?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because the N64 one had 3 tracks, and I think the DS game is some kind of port of the N64 game.
DS game is awful, but be that as it may, there's a lot more than 3 tracks. There's a ton of cars, and as you complete these events, you unlock more tracks and more cars. I think I've gone through about 4 events, which range from anywhere from 3 races to 5. I've got 7 or 8 cars at my disposal at this point, and they do feel slightly different. The 3D effect, though, in this game is really, really good. It's easily the best on the system. There's a real sense of depth to what's going on around you, because a lot of the tracks have buildings on each side. It actually is like the classical perspective study, because things get smaller as they recede into the background, and they actually have dimension to them now, so it makes the effect more embellished. The 3D is actually used to smooth out the car surfaces, so if you put it into 2D mode, the cars actually look more jagged.
Oh, that's that aliasing effect I've heard about.
Yeah, so I've heard that Nintendogs plus Cats does that too, where the effect of the 3D actually makes stuff look smoother.
That's probably... If I had to guess, I'd say that's probably because the cars, or the dogs, in the other case, are the closest thing to the screen. Mm-hmm. So they have the least differential between the angles that the screens are showing them.
Mm-hmm.
You've got two images that are almost literally on top of each other, but not quite. They're off by just a hair. And so when your eyes see that, they sort of merge the two together instead of seeing them separately. So basically, it's like the minimal amount of depth that you could see. And it's actually so small that instead of perceiving it as a difference in depth, you actually just kind of, the lines don't quite match up. And so it looks a little bit blurrier and aliased that way. So it would smooth out those lines.
It actually makes the cars look really kind of cool. Street Fighter does it a little bit too, actually. But it's most noticeable that I've seen in this game. Like I said, though, it is Ridge Racer. Lots of drifting through corners and somewhat arcadey racing. You can still careen into people and be relatively unpunished for it. But, you know, I've had fun with it. It did give me my first 3DS headache, which is disheartening because I thought I was immune to them.
Just keep drinking water as you go, and it'll you'll be glad you did the next morning.
Drink some coffee, James.
Or get up, and the first thing you do is play more 3DS, and it'll cure it right away.
Hair of the DS. Of the 3DS.
I'll go flip it over to some Raymans, and I'll just throw the 3DS out the other window. But the last game I've got is an Xbox indie game, which the name's actually in Japanese, so if you're looking for it, you're going to have to actually look for the game that has Japanese text on it. It reads Mamote Kishi, which translates roughly to Protect Me Knight. It's an 8-bit game, retro-styled, where you pick from four different classes, kind of gauntlety.
I was going to say gauntlet, because I've played the trial of it.
It's like a gauntlet tower defense game.
Mm-hmm.
There's up to four players. Each of you controls a character of a specific class. And then you basically beat the living crap out of a bunch of enemies that spawn who are trying to kill the princess at the middle of the screen. And you can use the currency you develop, which is her love, which you gain by killing things in combos, which is kind of whacked. So if you get a combo of 50 hits on things, you get a lot of love that you can then use to buy big emplacements to protect her. It's a fun arcade game. I was able to beat it single player on easy, but obviously it's intended for multiplayer. It's like that. It's like playing Gauntlet on your own. You can do it. It loses a lot.
Gauntlet Legends is okay on your own, but like the original Gauntlet and Gauntlet 2 are not so much.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
They're meant to be quarter munchers for sure.
Does anyone even know what Gauntlet is anymore? I mean, that franchise is just
gone. I mean, that's an important franchise.
It is, certainly.
Yeah, it got kind of lost, like, you know, with the N64 game, and they started getting kind of too 3D generic adventure-y.
Yeah, they really turned into basically dungeon crawlers.
Yeah.
That's true.
They kind of were dungeon crawlers before, but now they're just straight-up dungeon crawlers.
They sort of converged with modern dungeon crawlers,
yeah.
And they lost some of that insanely hectic identity that they... I mean, the thing about Gauntlet is it was one of the original cooperative multiplayer games.
Yeah.
Yep.
Even in the arcade, it was that way, and they're just... I don't think there was much like that at the time. And then it was certainly one of the first cooperative multiplayer games and one of the first four-player games to ever come to home consoles. I mean,
yeah.
People think of the multi-tap game as being Bomberman, but Bomberman didn't have multiplayer until Super Nintendo.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So long before that, you had Gauntlet and Gauntlet 2 on the NES that supported the four-player adapter that was pretty much made for Gauntlet.
Now, one of the things that, going back to Mamote Kishi, one of the things I like about this game, though, is it really does try to embrace this sort of retro-y feel. So when you start the game up, the first thing you have to do is blow dust out of a cartridge. which the game starts up, and you hear this clicking sound, and it's like a really screwed-up version of the start screen. Like, there's dust on it. Somebody stops the game, the screen turns into fuzz with the channel 2 at the top, and you have to press the A button until you blow dust out of the cartridge, and it starts up right.
Nice.
The game kind of has this, I mean, obviously, like I said, it's 8-bit. It's a limited color palette. It actually has really oddly good soundtrack for an indie game. I kind of wonder if this is more what Microsoft had in mind when they made indie games than most of the shit that's on there.
Right. Baby Maker 2 still with avatars.
Zombie Massage. But this is my first foray into the indie arcade that didn't end in me playing a game that I'm like, somebody literally just took a demo from the training kit and then slapped avatars on it. I don't know. It's if you have people to play it with, it's a fun game. I mean, I enjoyed it playing it by myself. It's dirt cheap. You can beat the whole game, I think, without paying for it. Maybe not the last level. But you can't select classes, so you're stuck with the fighter class, which is kind of
boring. Did you actually buy it?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
The other, I went through and played it with all the classes. They feel sufficiently different to merit their existence.
Cool.
I'm going to try to play it with people who I think would appreciate the game, but that's a pretty short list of people I know who would appreciate an incredibly Japanese 8-bit game played on the 360.
All right. So, John, you've been a busy man.
Yeah, busy man. I've been playing through the backlog a little bit, as much as I can. Still, you know, of course, still going on with Pokemon. Of course, Chrono Trigger. I did play a little bit of Chrono Trigger.
Nice. Now, what's your status in Pokemon? Are you still ramming through the gym leaders? Or
yeah, I'm still doing that. That's the thing. I haven't put too much more time into it. I'm just about to hit the second gym leader. I don't even know how many there are. That just shows you how much of a Pokemon person I am. But
there's 8, John. There's 8 gym leaders.
All right. Okay.
There's always been 8 gym leaders.
Yeah, unfortunately, that really is not probably never going to change. John, are you taking it to work with you or anything like that? Because I think Pokemon Black and White does have this Street Pass type functionality.
Yes.
I'm not exactly sure what it does, but
you can trade your
you can get surveys, right? Like you can get
You can trade your surveys.
I'm not at the point in the game yet where I can fill out the surveys, so I don't think that I can collect them.
Which people were getting to when they bought the game at PAX were getting to it the same day. Just to be
well,
clear.
Look, some people buy Harry Potter the night it comes out and read it the next day.
Yeah.
It's 900-page book. I know people who've done it.
Yeah, I just don't know. I mean, you know, I'm probably about 10 hours into the game, you know, just to give you an idea. But yeah, so I did bring it to work just for kicks one day, just to see if anything happened at all. I had, you know, I just, you know, shut it down. You can turn on the sea gear, whatever the heck they call it. And, you know, I didn't get any bites or anything, if anything was even supposed to happen at all. But yeah, so, you know, the one thing that bugs me is I think they could have done a better job overall with the interface. There's just so many things where, especially, I know.
You mean the interface from 1996, right?
Yeah, like I just really wish that there were ways to manage your Pokemon, especially when you swap out moves. You can see the stats of the move, and if there's a way to do this, somebody let me know. But
don't tell him.
You can see the stats of the move that you're thinking of tossing, but you can't see the stats for the move that you're replacing it with.
Yeah, I've always been bothered by that, and all I can figure is that they just want it to be a surprise, or they want it to be, you know, part of the risk.
Yeah.
But the thing is, if you play all the Pokemon games, there's no risk, you just know.
Mm-hmm.
So it really just punishes new people, because you could replace a good move with a crappy one and have no idea that that was a danger.
Yeah, or yeah, exactly, or not even, you know, because in some moves, if you don't know the game well enough, like you said, it'll be crappy now, but it could be amazing down the line. But you'll think it's crappy now, so you'll just be like, I'm going to get rid of that.
Well, there's a good example of that in the first few games where there's an attack called Vine Whip that just sucks.
Yeah.
But if you keep leveling up your grass starter, Vine Whip just starts ripping through Elite Four Pokemon that are weak to grass. Just destroys them.
Well, it probably has like what, low attack but high special attack or something. And when your character's low, then it doesn't have enough special ability to make good use of that.
But see, the thing is, it doesn't do almost anything to people who aren't weak to grass. It's just like 5, 5, 5.
Mm. Yep.
You hit something weak to grass, 80, 100.
It's super
200.
Effective.
Yeah.
They're down, and they're just gone. You're like, damn.
Yeah, and I'm also very hesitant with moves that are particularly good when you're fighting groups. Right, like if you're fighting, you know, three of your Pokemon against.
Oh, that's right, because they have the 3-on-3 battle now.
Yeah, that's new.
Because some of them, they're like, you know, this will cause a Pokemon on your team to power up, and then you can both use some super attack or something like that. And
yes.
When you first start out, that's useless, you know. And I mean, really, all you want is like the best moves that you can do on offense when you start out with, because you just want to cut through enemies. But that kind of stuff, like using your monsters as a team versus, you know, just doing one-on-one battles is entirely, you know, you would employ entirely different strategies. So sometimes I feel like I should just go up and buy a guide or something, or just go online to one of the Pokemon sites.
John, the internet.
Yeah.
It's not like there's a shortage of Pokemon-related websites.
I'd say there's some really, really good ones actually out there.
There's like 3 amazing websites that have more data than like Wikipedia.
Like Cerebi.net is probably, I would think,
Cerebi.net, and then there's a Pokemon wiki too that's really, really amazingly detailed. Like, these people have probably done enough work to earn PhD if Pokemon were real.
The scary thing about it's just one of those games like Minecraft, for instance, where you go online and start looking at a guide, and 2 hours later, you're still looking at the guide, and you think, I've been playing this all wrong. And you just, you fall into this pit of just horror.
That's what I did with Pokemon Red and Blue. I bought the guide because I was like, cool, you know, I'm gonna do everything I can do to get all the Pokemon I can. And I actually got trapped into this, okay, what does the guide say? All right, that is what I have to do. And it really just, sure, it sucked the fun right out of the game because,
right,
like, you know, I was afraid to experiment because I knew that if I did that, I would be, quote unquote, playing it wrong.
See, that's what I don't get, though, because that's a game where you really can't play it wrong. I mean, there's ways that you can probably maximize what your Pokemon are capable of, but ultimately, yeah, you can just play that game however the hell you feel like it. And you'll probably still be successful because ultimately, the game's not that difficult.
Well, the thing is, the goal is to make your Pokemon as powerful as you can. And the guides spell out a certain way to evolve your Pokemon so that they are powerful. You know, so when you know you're doing the wrong thing and you're not going to get the best monster at the end,
it drives you crazy.
Yeah, especially when you invest so much time in it. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just better not to know.
I think John's brought up an interesting issue, though, that could apply really to the larger, you know, issues of game design, which is that there are games in which knowing too much about it beforehand can actually, and I'm not talking about spoilers or anything, I'm talking about understanding how the underlying systems work,
yeah,
can actually make the game more intimidating and less satisfying because you don't feel like you're really playing it naturally anymore. You feel like you're just following the formula, the right way to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that only applies to certain kinds of games, and Pokemon is one of those. Whereas, like, let's say Mario. Like, you can read a guide to Mario, it's just going to be a walkthrough. You know, it's just like, if you have trouble in a certain place, it'll get you through it, and then you can stop reading it and keep playing the game or whatever. But there aren't so many underlying systems. It's just because Pokemon's so numbers-driven.
Yeah.
Even more than a normal RPG, it's very numbers-driven. And there's also a certain amount of randomness, and there's a lot of options. There's stuff like, you know, you can cancel evolution to keep your monster leveling up in its original form, and there's a lot of advantages to doing that. It's like, should I do that or not? Well, let me check the guide, you know, because it's not really clear within the game. The game doesn't give you all that much information about the results of all these. It tells you generally that all these options are out there, but it doesn't really tell you, you know, in the long run, what's the better way to do it. Mm-hmm. And generally there is a best way to do it, but the game's not going to tell you that. So that's why you end up going online. That is a big turnoff to me, actually. I don't like playing games like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one reason that I stopped playing Demon Souls after a few hours. Cause I just, you know, I only rented it anyway.
Yeah.
But I was having trouble. I wasn't really having that much fun. So I went online and thought, okay, I'm going to get a little bit of help here to see if it'll push me along. And I probably read a guide online for like 30 minutes. I'm like, okay, I don't want to play this anymore.
See, to me, in the case of Pokemon, though, it's not like you're going to get punished really badly because the game itself isn't very hard.
No. Don't forget, it's heavily based on Dragon Quest, which was, you know, the idea of the RPG that anyone could beat because of the grinding and all that kind of stuff. It still applies in Pokemon. And I've always played it ignorantly and enjoyed it ignorantly.
Yeah, that's all I want to do. My goal is to just play through this and just have fun doing it. Just play through it.
That's what you have to do.
Worry about that crap later.
I've experimented, and, you know, there's the move for Getter and stuff like that. And I was always able to say, well, this move really fucking sucks.
Yeah.
I'm going to go just get rid of it. And it's not like there's a shortage of money in Pokemon until you eliminated all the opposing trainers.
It's just always interesting around like games like this is that there's kind of like tiers of players. There's people that just play it just for the hell of it. And then there's always that second tier that breaks the game down into, you know, every single numeric, you know, element.
But the interesting thing is those people can actually ruin it for the rest of us. If we get too absorbed in what they're doing, you know, if we get distracted.
Just don't look.
But that's hard to do.
You're all right with unknown unknowns, but if it's a known unknown.
Right, I don't want this.
And that's got nothing to do with Uno and the Pokemon. I'm talking about a Rumsfeld thing here.
Yes, I know exactly what you're referencing. By the way, my favorite Uno was the one that looked like a K.
Okay, so Greg, what have you got this week?
Well, I did accomplish all 3 stars on Pilot Wings, which you don't get very much for. Admitted, it's a Pilot Wing 64 related Easter egg, basically, which is, you know, neat but trivial. But there is actually what seems to be a pretty cool reward if you get perfects on everything. but that is probably beyond my will to achieve in the near to medium term, let's say.
I'm still struggling with one three star.
Really?
Like, I missed it by apparently like 2 points one time. I was like, oh!
I've enjoyed it. I consulted with the log, the activity log, and I think the clock on that shows something like 17 hours or something. Now, I'm sure there's some fluff in there, but still got plenty of use out of it for the past... It's only been a couple of weeks, don't forget.
That's impressive. I mean, you're a power player.
Oh, these people have already got all the perfects. Like,
you're on the high end of the curve of the people who are going to...
Yeah, I mean, I'm never going to get all the perfects.
There's always a bigger fish, but I feel like I've got a lot out of it so far, and maybe I'll chip away at especially like the certain missions that I like that I could see myself just trying to get. I want to get a perfect on that damn squirrel suit mission, but there's that one point capsule that I can't get the point capsule and hit the goal properly.
Yes, I'd noticed that. It's almost impossible.
Yeah, I'm really struggling to see how on earth you could possibly do it. So I'd quite like to crack that particular nut eventually. Squirrel suit things are great, by the way. I don't know why that isn't reprised at some point.
Is it just one mission?
Yeah.
That's too bad.
It's like the jet. I would love to have used the jet more.
Yeah.
Now, I'm very happy that I don't have to use the super rocket belt more because that thing can bite me.
Well, I mean, I suppose, again, you could say this is a spoiler, but the reward if you get all the perfects is you can use the super vehicles on the normal missions and get better scores because you could do it faster.
Nice.
So you could then use the jet a hell of a lot, as well as, like, you could use the jet in free flight and there's the right bonus mission in the diamond class and stuff. But, yeah, moving on, Mega Man X, as we discussed last week, came out for the Japanese Virtual Console, or of course, Rockman X, the proper name, in Japan. I've been playing pretty feverishly on this one for the past couple of days. I am now close to the end, I believe, very, very close, in fact. I haven't quite beaten it yet, but I would say it's probably... I don't know whether I want to say significantly, but it's noticeably sort of easier for me to get through than the classic Mega Mans that I've played.
More than two?
Definitely easier than two.
Really?
I've beaten two, but...
Remember, this is what happened with the Mega Man franchise. One was hard because they had no clue what the F they were doing.
Yeah.
Two was hard because they willed it to be hard.
Wait. Mega Man 2, the game in which you can use the same weapon on and almost every boss is weak to it.
Well, yeah, if you do that, but I mean...
And it uses almost no ammo and can be shot in 8 directions. You're telling me that is harder than Mega Man X?
I actually beat a lot of the bosses in Mega Man X with the X Buster.
The X Buster is really effective.
I actually kind of like it better that way because spamming something that kills it really easily has never been my idea of fun. So I got into some, like I said, not necessarily really hard, but some tense battles that I could lose. But I mean, really, I guess the hardest part of Mega Man 2 is just the last part, you know, the Wily's Castle stuff.
It is.
And to be fair, I haven't finished that part of Mega Man X yet, so...
And it's the same. Mega Man X 3 is where in this case, it's Sigma's castle, gets really fucking insidious. Because in that game, there's just crazy shit that happens that's just never happened in Mega Man games before. Like, they've just never done this to you, this particular brand of evil. And you're like, what? Oh god, I died.
But I mean, there is the issue also, the fact that in X, Mega Man, he's more capable.
Yeah, he's not worthless, essentially.
You're clinging to the walls, you're jumping off the walls, you've got the dash and all that. So the dash wall jump is very, very useful in boss battles for dodging attacks that would otherwise be really difficult to avoid. So
see, I forgot that you don't start with the dash in X1 because...
That's right, you don't.
But, I mean, you can't avoid it. You literally cannot not get
it. You can avoid it for quite a while, as I found out. Okay, so we knew Greg was going to be playing this, and so James and I both kicked in Mega Man X Collection.
Yes.
And I played it with my Hori Digital GameCube controller, which is apparently highly sought after and
valuable.
Yes,
they are.
I'm thinking about selling mine because I can get...
But you know, the best solution for this situation, if you want to play something like that on GameCube, is what I use for the Virtual Console. It's those RetroZone ports that you use to play. I play all my Virtual Console games with a Super Nintendo controller.
Nice.
And that, of course, works by plugging into the GameCube port. So you could use that for... I've used it to play GBA games. on my Game Boy player, you know, and anything kind of retro on the GameCube. So that's the best way to go because it's perfect.
Well, yeah. I mean, let me just quickly go over the Hori Digital Pad because this is apparently a legendary controller.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, it's a collector's item.
Yeah, see, I didn't even know that it was that. I hardly ever use
it. Yeah, so Johnny found out it was really expensive from an email I sent him complaining that I didn't have one.
Yeah.
I should have just been like, man, I really wish I had one of those things, but I mean, I can get them for a dollar on eBay.
How much you give me for it, James?
not as much.
Let's work it out on the air.
Isn't his friendship enough, Johnny?
That's right. Not as much as people would give you online, let's put it that way.
Well, I shouldn't say this before I sell it, if I am going to sell it, but this thing is not worth $100 or whatever it's going for. It's really not.
Well, especially when you can, like I said, you could buy, what I don't know whether you could still buy, I bought mine years ago.
Yeah.
I know Aaron reviewed the NES one, that's how I first heard about the whole RetroZone adapter thing. But especially when products like that exist, why the hell is this controller so sought after?
I don't know. It's a weird thing. Maybe it's like the keyboard controller for Phantasy Star.
Just curiosity.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Hori did make a bunch of really, really good GameCube controllers because they could actually use Nintendo's, not their molds, but they could base it off Nintendo's molds.
They were officially licensed.
Right, which as we've learned, Nintendo lost the molds for a lot of their controllers.
Oh, God.
Supposedly.
Fucking terrible.
That goes back to like when we first started doing the show.
Yes. So I mentioned it because I'm actually playing the game with the WaveBird. Which, actually, the WaveBird is a little bit different than the regular GameCube controller on how the buttons feel.
Yeah.
But back to the Hori. The Hori is essentially shaped like an SNES controller. There's no thumbsticks. There's a big D-pad because the GameCube D-pad is highly insufficient.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's got the four buttons on the other side, and that's basically it.
But the four buttons on the right side are in the GameCube shape. So
right.
It's the giant green A button, the little bitty B button, and then the bean-shaped X and Y.
Yes.
And those buttons are fine. The shoulder triggers also are very good. They're digital. They're not analog.
Right.
And you have this this purple circular Z button that's on the face.
Oh, yeah,
you can
that's right.
Easily reach with your thumb. So that's nice, too, although you're not likely to ever use
it.
There's
only about 8 games that use the Z button, and none of them could be controlled with this thing.
And oddly enough, it has a select button.
Oh, that's right, it does!
I don't think it does anything in any game, because GameCube doesn't have a select button.
It's just there!
I think it's a piece of plastic that you can push, and that's all. It's really weird, but... Yeah, so the thing about the Hori Digital Pad is that you can only use it in games that have no use whatsoever for the joystick because it just doesn't have one.
Right. And it was called the Hori Game Boy Player controller. I mean, it was for the Game Boy Player.
Okay, yeah.
But why not just go the whole hog and make the buttons more orthodox?
Exactly. Exactly.
Because they wanted to basically show that we are officially Nintendo licensed.
I mean, yeah, that might have been a stipulation from Nintendo, I'm not sure.
I mean, the D-pad is the standard Nintendo D-pad.
No, it's not.
It's okay. Not? Really?
Nope. That's where I'm going to stop you. And that's my big problem with this controller, because I like the controller. It's very lightweight. It's thin. It's a little bit thicker on the edges where your grip is. The buttons have a good press to them. They feel like official... I mean, they feel exactly like GameCube buttons. And the triggers are good on the top. All that's nice. My problem with the Hori Digital Pad is that the D-pad itself is not good enough. It is big. It's twice the size of the GameCube D-pad.
The GameCube one is just the original GBA one. It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
It appears to be the size of the SNES D-pad.
It is. It's actually maybe slightly larger than the Super Nintendo one, but it's much stiffer, so you have to push harder on it.
Well, it sounds like the N64 one.
Yeah.
Because that looked like the Super Nintendo one, but it did not feel like it.
Right. It's a little more like that. It's stiffer. You have to put more pressure on the buttons to make them activate. And like the... And I think the Super Nintendo controller had these little arrow-shaped depressions on them, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It has that, but because it's stiffer, it causes blisters on your thumbs, especially from a game like Mega Man, where you're kind of doing it fast and it's a very high-intensity game. It hurts. My thumb hurts after playing this for, you know, an hour or two. And I don't recall that ever being a problem on Super Nintendo.
No. As I said, this control, I'm using a Super Famicom controller that I had from 20 years ago now. It still works, and it still
broken
doesn't hurt my hand. It's perfect for this kind of stuff, obviously.
It really does feel like, though, this controller was made, they basically just borrowed a bunch of molds from Nintendo and said, all right, we'll bring them back. I mean, if you look at it, it's a mutant. It has what we've apparently determined is the N64 D-pad with the SNES shell and the GameCube buttons.
Bizarre.
Frankenstein's joypad.
It's like they broke into the Nintendo factory. It's like, all right, we have to steal a bunch of molds.
Take whatever you can. Let's get the hell out of here.
And actually, from having... And we will get back to the actual game, but from having played... From having played through the majority of Mega Man X in the past couple days on this thing, it has convinced me that I probably would pay for this game on Virtual Console so that I could play it with the Classic Controller Pro, which has an equally large D-pad that is much more comfortable because it has no depressions on it, and it's sensitive enough that you don't have to mash down on it to activate it. And all the buttons are the right shape and in the right place, which is a minor problem for Mega Man X. I mean, you can certainly hold down B while you tap A,
yes,
and you can use a shoulder button for dash, so it works, but it's not ideal.
Yeah, I actually, the various ways I played Mega Man X in the past, including on a keyboard. I beat
lovely.
Mega Man X 4 on a keyboard, so take that. I actually have found a semi-comfortable way with which I can lay the thumb across the B, A, and X buttons, extending the knuckle. It's completely fucked. I mean, it's like if somebody watched it, they would think I was holding the controller like I'd never seen a video game before. I mean, it's a disaster to watch, but it works.
So, yeah, Mega Man X, have I been enjoying it? Yes, I have.
It's a roundabout way of getting to that conclusion.
It is a very, very enjoyable game. The graphics are very charming. They're big, bold, nicely animated. They slow down a bit here, there. It gets a bit much for it, but you expect that from if you've played a lot of even the best Super Nintendo games, you're used to that. Like I said, I've generally found it a bit easier, but no less pleasurable for that. You know, as I said, some of it's related to the fact the game is a little bit more playable because Mega Man has more capabilities. But one of the more interesting things I found about it was the parts where you're kind of exploring to find upgrades and things, which is, yeah, I mean, there was little, you know, nooks and crannies to find some items in the classic Mega Man games, but here it's kind of expanded. Like, right. I think the first time I found one of the heart meter kind of upgrades was in the octopus level.
Launch octopus.
Yeah, and I think the names might be different in
Japanese.
Oh, they are.
Yeah,
some amusing ones. What's the Boomer Wanger one?
Boomer Kawanger.
He's a
I don't know what a Kawanger is, but
he is what he is. Let's put it that way.
So the thing about in Mega Man X, instead of everything being blank man or woman,
they gave them names.
They're all animals of some kind.
Yeah. But on his days, the octopus guy, there's a part where you've got these like jets of water that shoot up. And so I had come back to the stage, having sort of failed to beat it earlier on, with some more powers, thinking, oh, well, maybe I've got his weakness now. I didn't. But anyway. But this time, I was messing around with those jets, and it kind of, if you let it shoot you up in the air, and then you cling onto the side of something, then you get onto this like little battleship, and
yes,
if you shoot it down, it crashes through the floor and opens
yes
up this whole other section. And then you fight a little mini-boss, and then there's a health upgrade, and stuff mm-hmm like that. You've got sub-tanks you can find. There's just completely kind of new abilities, like being able to headbutt through blocks is one of them.
Barely used.
It's basically used to get another upgrade. That's
yeah
it.
Yeah, yeah. I think I got a sub tank with it.
No. You get the cannon upgrade.
The buster update, yeah.
Yeah, see, I got that anyway from the first Sigma level.
Yes. If you don't already have it by then, Zero will give it to you. But then...
Because you need it.
But Zero dies, doesn't he?
Obviously, he doesn't die because he comes back into the next six games.
I want to say that maybe he comes back later in the game. If you manage to keep him alive, he comes back later in the game and does something for you. I can't remember exactly.
So I know in X3, if you do things in a certain order and do stuff, Zero comes in when you're fighting a boss and manages to get himself killed. Thanks, Zero.
You can actually play as him for a certain
portion. For brief periods of time, but not when you're fighting bosses, because the Z-Saber in X3 is instant death to any boss.
Mm.
So if you do things in the right order in that game and Zero dies, you get his saber
mm-hmm
right before you go into the boss rush room, where you have to go through the eight bosses. Swat, dead, whack, dead. And you're just like, all right, that took off 30 seconds. I got through all 8 bosses. What's next?
Well, the really fun thing about X3, is, speaking of slowdown, is that there's a part where Zero will give you his Z Buster. And so you actually have charge shots on both arms. And so you charge, and when you charge up all the way, you'll shoot like this big shot. And then if you push the button again before that shot is off the screen, you'll shoot another shot that's faster that will catch up to the first shot, and they'll intersect and like explode into this giant sonic boom like screen filling wave, and the game just dies when you do this. But it's so awesome
because and if you get the saber after that, then you can use his sword as the next attack, and the game just dies. It's just like I can't handle what's going on right now, please stop.
Yeah, and this is by the point where they had in like their third generation Capcom crazy MMC chip in the game, which is partly why it's hard to emulate. And also I played X3 and I got frustrated with a part of it, and I was like, I want to skip ahead to, I mean, I played X and then I skipped ahead to X3 because I wanted to like compare like how much did they jump forward in the span of the Super Nintendo lifetime. And X3 looks significantly better. The music definitely sounds better.
The music is way better.
There's a little more animation. Of course, you start with the dash, which changes the level. In X2, you start with the dash also, and that changes the level design, actually. Because in the first one, they have to design the boss levels assuming that you don't have the dash, because it is possible to play through 7 of them
without the dash. You could go to Chill Penguin last and be like, what the hell are they telling me this was here?
Luckily, I went to him second, so that kind of worked out.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is though some changes that seem to happen to levels.
Yes.
If you've beaten things. Like, one of the weirdest ones I found, because like obviously everyone goes on about Mega Man having a bit of a backwards difficulty thing. You know, it gets easier as you acquire more weapons and stuff. Mm-hmm. But in this case, obviously you've also got like these abilities. You can find like extra armor and stuff. So and the sub tanks and the health upgrades. So it's kind of even more dramatic. But there was one that was really inexplicable, which was I played the Mandrill guy, the electric mandrill level.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it was one of the first ones that I tried.
Spark mandrill.
Yeah. And it seemed really hard because like there was all electricity going through the floors. And then I beat a bunch of bosses and I come back, and then the levels are all blacked out.
Yes.
It suffered a loss of power. And so then the level was far easier because there's no hazards, which is a really weird thing to do, because you'd think changing the levels based on if you've actually beaten other ones could be a way of mitigating the problem of the backwards difficulty curve rather than making it worse.
So
I was perplexed by that.
What that does do to that level, though, is because it's blacked out, the platforming becomes a little bit more difficult.
You could still see everything.
Well, you can, unless you're playing it on the TV I'm playing it on, then I'm like, shit, I can't tell if there's a hole there. Oh, there's a hole. Fuck. Yeah, I mean, that level's almost impassable until the electricity's gone. I mean, it really is incredible.
Yeah, that was the first one I picked. And I was like, God, they weren't kidding. This is hard as hell.
Some of the levels are very difficult without dash. I mean, they're possible. They have to be, but they're very hard.
So it's if you kill Flame Mammoth, it turns off the power. If you kill
if you kill Chill Penguin, it puts out the flames in Flame Mammoth stage, so you can walk on the on the ground.
If you do something else, it puts water in the Sting Chameleon level, so you can reach a heart tank. I mean, there's a lot of crazy crap going on. But one of the things about the boost is that without it, the Flame Mammoth boss battle is actually kind of hard.
Yeah, I did him without the dash, actually. It was quite hard, but again, doable. Like, a lot of these bosses were doable without the weapon, or, you know, they kind of felt pretty well balanced that way.
I did a run of this game a long time ago where I didn't pick up any hearts, any tanks, and I only had to get the boost because it's mandatory, and then the gun later. And, it's hard.
Yeah.
That's the thing, like, you have to start somewhere. So all the bosses have to be defeatable without anything special. It's just some of them are harder than others, but you could start pretty much anywhere. And yeah, if you think that the hard tanks and the sub tanks and stuff like that make it too easy, then don't get them.
Yeah, I mean, I just did it to see if I could, and
Right.
I definitely haven't had to do any grinding. I mean, I've used the subtext, but they've just been kind of filled naturally at various times, especially because you will want to go back to levels to see, like, right. Well, you know, there was that thing there before that I couldn't do anything with, but now I've got...
They do feel faster in this game than they do in some of its sequels. I've noticed that.
Right.
What I've noticed, though, is that the pacing in this game is really bad compared to games that come after it.
Well, in terms of pacing, I think my biggest, probably my biggest qualm with the whole game, and it's not, you know, it's not a big deal because this is a pretty rare problem, but is where the gameplay goes vertical.
Oh,
there's
really?
A handful of sections where you're clambering up a vertical shaft and you kind of have to swap sides every now and again and deal with some enemies and stuff. And this is where the game's propensity to respawn enemies the second they've gone off the screen is annoying.
Yeah, it's
because
pain,
it's like
yes.
you jump Mother up God. And shoot something, and then once you reestablish yourself on the side, you slip just a little bit and then he's back.
Well, you
it's
know,
not quite Ninja Gaiden, but it's a little
those
close.
Those ostrich things, you don't even have to get them fully off the screen. All you have to do is get their stupid afro wig off the screen, and that's enough for them to come back.
But those vertical bits, you know, they're just a bit slow and fiddly compared to the rest of the game, where you're just continually clambering up and up and up, and you've got these enemies that just keep coming back and stuff. I think there's about three cases of that I could think of, so it's not a big part of the game.
I think there's a really nasty one in the last level of the game, but that's...
There are some abilities that if you charge them up, they will help you a lot through that
stuff. the chameleon temporary invincibility thing lasts for quite a while.
No, it's completely broken.
I've generally avoided using that because it does seem a bit much, although there is one bit I found in one of the Sigma levels which seems deliberately designed to exploit it, because there's just a bunch of items on spikes which
probably.
I assume you couldn't get any other way. I don't think you could manage to get up there and use the boomerang to snag them,
right?
But with the chameleon thing, you just activate it before
Done.
You get the spikes and just run and you've got them all, and that's pretty useful. But those are cool, the using all the different powers. They kind of remind me of those wacky things in Super Metroid, like the secret item crushes that you could do with each beam, but obviously nowhere near a secret and quite a lot more useful.
My favorite is the heart container, that the way you get it is you make an ice sled and let it run off of a ledge, and because it does so with enough velocity that it kind of takes you out past the ledge, and then you can jump back up and get it. That description made no sense to the listeners at home, but if you've played the game, you probably know the one I'm talking about.
Later in the series, basically every item becomes prerequisite with another item or another boss skill. So in the first game, they're still kind of feeling that out. But later in the game, there's one where I think it's an X3. You have to have the Volt Catfish power. Really. Volt Catfish.
Awesome.
And if you charge it... No, it's Gravity Beetle. And you charge it up, and the entire game's gravity essentially inverts briefly because you've used his charge-up gravity well. And that takes you straight up to the capsule, but you have to jump off as soon as you can, or you're going to get reamed by spikes. But you can't see it. You're just standing on this platform.
Oh, I think I know which one you're talking
about. And then you're
about.
Wait, there's a big shaft there.
Because you think you can sort of air dash up there, but you can't quite make it.
And if you do it wrong, you hit spikes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, game. And by wrong, I mean if you attempt it at all. But the pacing for me in this game was where it puts checkpoints.
They're a bit odd sometimes.
It puts them in some pretty fucked places. The area you were talking about, where you get the heart when you kill the sea worm monster.
Yeah.
He's actually one of the cooler bosses in the series, and I'm glad.
He takes forever to kill.
Oh, not if you've got the tornado thing.
No,
he's
just
dead very quickly with that.
You're gone.
Well, if you kill him with a Mega Buster, it takes 5 minutes.
No, I've done both. And yes.
Well, see, what's funny
difference.
About him is. Capcom created this really amazing mini boss, and then they thought, well, that's pretty cool. They then decided that he was good enough and they didn't need to bring him back, except they brought him back a bunch of different times with different colors throughout the series. Nice job.
I do like
creative.
To be, I mean, obviously the animal robots are, you know, very much like the Robot Masters, and
right.
You know, it's, you're in a room, it's a box, they have a gun, but There's a lot, quite a nice collection of these mini bosses, or sort of, or once you get to the Sigma levels, like just, you know, they're actually the end bosses of the levels,
right?
That are, you know, very different from that template, and they're all pretty good in my experience.
Well,
so far.
The spider boss can go fuck itself.
And
though.
The tank.
It's like it was a mini game that's exactly like that in Super Mario 64 DS. One of those multiplayer games where you just got to look at the paths and guess where it's going to finish.
The fuck him.
So, Greg, I think you're giving short shrift to the boss bosses.
They're good too, but they're just a lot more like what you used to from Mega Man.
But they're so much different. Again, you're giving short shrift to it because in all the original Mega Man games, the bosses are the same size as Mega Man, and they generally move with. Roughly, they might jump higher than he does, but they generally move with the same abilities. I think later on there may be one or two that can stick to walls or something like that, but, you know, they pretty much run around and jump, and they try to run into you. And the bosses in Mega Man X, because they're based on animals, they are all kinds of different shapes and sizes, like Flame Mammoth, which you mentioned before. He is 3 times bigger than Mega Man. He's absolutely enormous, which is something you've never seen before in any Mega Man game. And his whole boss stage is about twice as wide as a normal boss room, and it has a conveyor belt on it that he can switch directions on.
That one is different, to
be fair.
And
he can leap across it because mammoths are known for their long leaping abilities.
There are some with spikes in the room. You've got characters like, you've got a chameleon who's swinging from the ceiling and then he turns invisible because he's crawling on the background.
Chill Penguin who shoots himself around the room like a jackass.
Yeah, the bosses are and also if you use the weapon that they're weak against, there's usually a special animation which kind of cues you into, hey, this is doing something special. And some of them you can actually affect permanent changes on them, like the armor armadillo guy.
Yeah, you take it away, he's naked, basically.
If you use the electric part on it, it takes away his armor, which makes him much easier to kill.
I think you can cut Flame Mammoth's trunk off, too, if you use the boomerang.
Oh, that's harsh.
It's pretty awful. But for me, though, I had kind of let the other Mega Man games I've played more, the X games, the later ones, sort of make me forget that this game is still somewhere between what is the prototypical Mega Man X game and a late Mega Man game. Like I was saying earlier, the checkpoints are kind of messed up because they'll put a checkpoint before one mini-boss, and then they'll chain like 4 mini-bosses in a row and not give you a checkpoint after any of them. And, which, in that case, where you killed that thing, that was after you've already killed 2 mini-bosses, then you kill him. Then when you climb out, you have to kill another one of him, and then you get a checkpoint.
I'm pretty sure that X came out before Mega Man 7 on Super Nintendo.
It probably did.
It definitely came out before Mega Man 8 on PlayStation and Saturn.
X2 and X3 and X4, the bosses start to feel more eventful. Mm-hmm. And X5, the series just goes in a tailspin.
Don't even play 6.
Six is a cluster. 7 gave us Bamboo Pandemonium. And 8 can go fuck itself. But 7 will always have a place in my heart because of Bamboo Pandemonium.
Bamboo Pandemonium. I so want Capcom to make Mega Man X9 for WiiWare and Xbox Live Arcade and PSN. And then go on with 10. And I want Mega Man 9, 10 treatment for X, because it is a different series with a very different feel. And it's, at this point, it's almost 20 years old. So it's got just as much nostalgia for X as I do for the original. Well, that's been Retroactive Mega Man X Edition. And I'm gonna wrap up new business with Fragile Dreams, Farewell to Ruins of Gameplay. This is the game that it came out early last year, I guess. James was a big fan of it and lamented that it didn't win any Game of the Year awards.
It did, actually. It won a presentation award.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the presentation is the best thing about the game.
It was the sound. He was adamant he wanted it to win something.
There's almost no music in the game. It's mostly silent.
But the ambiance, Johnny. The ambiance.
There's not even that much ambiance.
I disagree.
It makes good use of the Wii Remote speaker. I mean, as good as you can make. You know, it does a nice job of that. And the graphics are pretty good. I think the character designs are bad, but that's not worth discussing. But yeah, this is a sort of third-person It's actually kind of survival horror.
It's like I said, it's Resident Evil gameplay.
It feels like Resident Evil 1 through 3.
Yeah.
So the ones that I hate.
That's
James did make this very clear when he spoke about it on the show.
That went right through my head because that didn't register.
Well, you don't have to edit them, admittedly.
If you go back and listen to that, I probably said that multiple times.
Oh, I'm very confident
of
that.
I wish I had, because I, you know, I was like...
Could have done due diligence, Johnny.
In fact, if you go and read the review, you'd also note that I said the same thing.
And that's not even as diligent.
I basically said the gameplay is kind of junky, but the presentation makes up for it.
I'm just laying it out there. The gameplay is bad. The controls are bad. And I expected that to some degree, okay? And I was willing to do that because I remember James saying that he loved the story and he loved the presentation. Where I disagree with James is that the presentation makes up for all that other stuff. It doesn't. So I played this for 5 hours, and I kind of want my 5 hours back, but I got to the part where you do a scavenger hunt that sends you back to all the places you've been before to find arbitrary shit to give to this girl to let her through for no reason, and I'm done.
Yeah, that's the worst part of the game, easily.
I didn't like it before that, and I'm not going to go through an hour of doing that crap. So don't play Fragile Dreams.
I disagree.
That's my recommendation, is do not play it. If you are a whore for anime shit like James, then you might find elements of it that you like, but the voice acting is terrible, the character designs are terrible, the writing is terrible.
Or if you read any review written by any outlet ever that essentially agrees entirely with what I said.
I don't know what redeeming qualities there are in this game, other than there's this one part where you go outside and you see the sky and it's colorful and pretty. That's like the only thing I like about this whole game. I'm sad that I played Fragile Dreams. It was better in my mind as a known unknown.
So many things are.
And I don't want to talk about it anymore. So it's time for a break. When we come back after Now Playing, we have your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We have online impressions of The Last Story from Danny, and with Xenoblade finally coming out in English, you can transfer your JRPG lust to this game. And Josh and Andrew have created the Fan Art Showcase, a roundup of the internet's best Nintendo fan art, and put it in one convenient article for your viewing pleasure.
And in what is promising to be an ongoing feature, we have If I Were in Charge of Zelda, in which staff members take turns describing how they would manage the Zelda franchise. We already have entries by Nicholas and Pedro, with more on the way. And in a new entry of Extra Life, Zach takes a look back at Pokemon Pinball, Ruby, and Sapphire, the GBA sequel, because you can never catch them all enough times. Words to live by.
In reviews this week, we have the long-awaited Tom Clancy's Hawks 2 from James, if you've forgotten that this is the game that makes it feel like an F-18 all the time. Finally, you can read the Innocent Ace's devastating review of this Wii Flight Simulator. Does it stand up to Ace Combat or even Skycrawlers? That's a rhetorical question.
Rumor has it it's a failure, but I don't...
You can play as a bird.
No, you have to play as a bird. It's mandatory.
A bird in a space shuttle.
And our next review is for Steel Diver, Neil, with yet another 3DS game. This time he's looking at Nintendo's long-delayed Submarine Simulator. Is it still just a tech demo, or is there a real game in here?
All right, and we have 3DS System Impressions from TYP, and I know what you're thinking. The 3DS is already out. A lot of people already have them. Maybe you have your own already. Why would you want
to
read this?
You might be listening to this on one.
Yeah, indeed. TYP actually has an interesting approach to the system, and he looks at the top 5 pros and the top 5 cons of the 3DS hardware. So it is actually pretty interesting, and there's some good comments in the forums for that one. So be sure to check out Nintendo World Report every day for the latest news, screenshots, videos, and much more. We even have an update on Pandora's Tower, the mysterious new Wii game from Japan. And we are back for everyone's favorite part of the show. It's listener mail time. And, you know, before we get rolling into this, I do want to thank everybody who has been writing in, everybody who's ever written in, because you guys really make up a huge part of the show. This is a big chunk of what we do, and we really appreciate it. And James has the first email.
I do have the first email. Caesar, or Cesar, we don't know which one, from Australia writes, "My question this week is about obscure games from the days of yore that have next to no chance of getting a re-release. Some of my favorite NES and SNES games as a child were fished out of the bargain bins or bought on the basis of their wicked cool box art. Games like Burai Fighter, Wizards and Warriors 3, Kuros, Visions of Power, The Guardian of Legend, Robo Warrior, and Skyblazer share two things in common. One, I love them as a youngster. And two, there's a greater chance of John Lindemann beating Chrono Trigger than any of those games ever seeing any sort of release on the virtual console or any downloadable service. Anyway, do you have a comment, John?"
I have no comment.
Right, John, you did say you'd played it a bit more earlier. Just give it to me straight. I promise I won't laugh. Where are you?
I am at the point where Frog opens up the mountain with his sword.
Oh, cool. I love that part.
It was an awesome part.
Anyway, my question for you is, what, if any, beloved games are there from your childhoods do you long for but will likely never see again? Why are they lost in limbo? Have they become abandonware forever? What hope is there that I'll be able to play these games again through legitimate means?"
Well, I'm glad Cesar brought up Wizards and Warriors 3, because that, I don't know that if I would have thought of that on my own, but it actually would be on my list. That's a rare game for NES. It's really good. The first couple Wizards and Warriors are kind of dicey.
They had to get in the rhythm.
But the third one actually really opens up. Your character can turn into three different classes and actually get upgrades to those classes. So it's much more of an adventure game. You feel like your character changes as you play through it. It's a huge kind of open world sort of thing. It's a very interesting game. It's hard. Very, very hard. You probably would want some kind of guide to help you get through it, because the world is so big and not directed. You're not really sent through it on any particular path, but it is a very interesting NES game, and I would love to play that again. Of course, with Rare being in the situation it is, that's unlikely. I don't even know if they would still hold the rights to that.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. My suggestion for this is also from Rare, Cobra Triangle on NES. One of the last games that I ever had for the NES before it broke. And I have fond memories of playing it, but I would very much like to play it again, because it's quite a unique kind of game. Wasn't it sort of like a successor to that?
RC Pro-Am.
Yes. Yeah, RC Pro-Am, yes. Yeah.
Only you're on a boat and there was a dragon in the water.
Yeah, you're on a boat and there's like different kinds of missions. So sometimes it is just like a race, but then other times you're fighting like sea monsters. So that, you know, my memories of it are good but vague. So that would be right at the top of the list for this sort of thing. But as Johnny alluded to, Rare, there's no signs that they're, you know, mining their pre-Super Nintendo, you know, the pre-Donkey Kong Country era. They have a lot of stuff on Nintendo systems that was, you know, quite well thought of, like Solar Jetman.
Solar Jetman is a bastard of a game.
That is well said. I read good reviews for that game.
Very good. It's one of the hardest games I've ever
played. Here's the thing. They developed these games, but a lot of them were Nintendo published, so
RC Pro-Am is Nintendo published game, I believe.
It says Cobra Triangle. It's one of those weird situations where it really depends on how that contract was originally structured with Nintendo, who owns the game. And they've probably lost it knowing these two companies.
Yeah, I mean, there's no sort of way of knowing exactly how all that falls out, but the indications are that whoever's responsible or whatever, there's no movement on any of that stuff. At all. I mean, an obvious answer to this question is licensed stuff. So you have DuckTales, or, you know, like the DuckTales is too prominent. It doesn't fall into the obscure category. But, you know, I mean, stuff like that was licensed. So it probably isn't going to come back because no one's going to go to the effort. But, I mean, at least you had one case of that getting resolved for Virtual Console, which was the TMNT NES game. Mm-hmm.
The one that I could have totally lived without. Like, I'd rather have The Little Mermaid than TMNT.
You know, that came through with a 100 point premium on it for getting all the licensing.
For the extra suffering.
Yeah.
to pay the legal fees,
probably. But something like Rare's back catalog, there's nothing. There's no movement on that. So I have no optimism whatsoever.
I would say that it's unlikely.
Yeah, it's probably just dead in the water now that they're owned by Microsoft.
Which is sad, but it is what it is, unfortunately.
While we're on that tip, can I just throw out there Blast Corps.
You can if you want.
It's so good.
That and Jet Force Gemini are the perennial, although I think Blast Corps is better.
I would much rather have Jet Force Gemini. I feel like it's
I like both, but Blast Corps is more unique.
It is.
People have taken things about Jet Force Gemini.
If you played Gears of War,
games,
you've kind of played Jet Force
Gemini.
Yeah,
I mean, it's quite seminal in a way as a third-person shooter, but Blast Corps. I mean, what have you played that satisfies you in the similar way in the 14 years hence?
Actually, if you really want to play an update to Jet Force Gemini, go play Ratchet and Clank. They are slavishly dedicated
There's
to that.
There's definite similarities there, whereas Blast Corps, I've got nothing. But that was very, very entertaining.
They even made a movie out of Blast Corps. I think it's called Unstoppable with Chris Pine and Denzel Washington.
Denzel, yeah.
So that's a Scott joint.
Yeah, Scott Free Productions. Probably Tony. Tony does all
that's
them.
Right. Tony Scott. He made the Blast Corps movie. Check it out.
Yes.
I look forward to actually watching that film with the Blast Corps soundtrack, the banjo playing in the background.
The soundtrack's so good in Blast Corps.
I think you need to watch that film with liquor.
By the way, the great thing about Blast Corps is it also kind of contains a new RC Pro-Am as well with all those race levels. That are quite good.
Yeah, I mean, the vehicles really, you know, handle in a great diversity of ways, but they all handle pretty well. Mm-hmm. That's what's surprising, you know, because you could have games based around principally one kind of vehicle that don't handle that well. So having a whole bunch of them in one game doesn't sound like it necessarily would turn out that tight, but they all work as far as I remember. But I'm lucky I still have an N64 I could hooked up to my current television. I could quite easily play that anytime I like. But for a lot of people, I think it would be a really cool game to discover or rediscover.
All right, well, let's go outside of the rare box.
Well, I mean, in terms of games from my childhood, which is way the hell back there.
Commodore 64.
Well,
no, way older than that.
I mean, they've already had like some of the classic games.
Rockwell painting.
Some of the classic games from the Commodore 64 days have already come out on VC, so that's been good. Yeah. But in terms of Atari 2600 games, you see a lot of like Atari's stuff being, you know, they're releasing their greatest hits collections and stuff like that. So a lot of those are still out there. But way back, I used to play games from a company called Imagic. Way back, there was Atlantis Demon Attack.
Oh no!
Yeah, they came on. They came on. They had their own uniquely shaped 2600 cartridges.
Yes.
They were silver with like orange with an orange stripe across them. If you could see them, you knew exactly what they were right away. And they were only in business for about 5 years, and they went under with the rest of the 2600 business pretty much. But yeah, they had some really really good games. So I would love to see like I don't know if they would have enough games to actually put out an entire, you know, like release them all as one collection. But that's the whole thing with a lot of the 2600 stuff. I mean, you are getting straight up ripped off if you pay for them because those games are like they're
sub Game & Watch in some cases. I mean, I've played Atari 2600 games that I remember liking as a kid, even though I mean that system was retro by the time I was old enough to play it.
Yep.
Basically. But I liked it, you know. I mean, I knew people who had them and I enjoyed playing them, and I've gone back and I think Yar's Revenge is one of the only ones that actually holds up as being still a fun game to play.
Yeah.
Most of those 2600 games, it's like you play it for 60 seconds and you're done, man.
Yeah. Pitfall's still very good.
See, what for me, what's interesting is if I go look at old Atari games, I'm just kind of blown away by how awful and primitive they are. Mm-hmm. But there's a bunch of games that I played back on the Intellivision in the day that I still think are kind of fun.
Did you have an Intellivision?
It was my parents, but yes, I had one.
Hmm.
With the voice box, which is awesome.
Wait, what is that?
It's a peripheral you plug into the cartridge slot, then you plug a cartridge into it, and some games talk through it. so like B-17 Bomber would talk to you while you were playing it.
Uh-huh. Could you understand it?
Kinda. I mean, it'd be like, fuck. And you're like, oh, I'm being shot at from flat cannons. Perfect. But yeah, I mean, it was actually mostly intelligible, but it was completely insane, and it was this huge like growth sticking out the side of an already gigantic console.
Did it have its own speaker?
No, it actually came out of the TV.
Huh.
I guess it just added another sound processor to the unit.
Is the Intellivision controller the one that looks kind of like NES but with a silver metal joystick popping up out of instead of the D-pad?
The Intellivision controller is a clusterfuck. It is a number pad.
It's like a calculator type of deal.
Like on a phone.
With overlays.
You slide in overlays. And then instead of a D-pad, it's got a dial. And then also had these two buttons on the side of the controller that are almost impossible to depress because they're so hard. it is one of the worst controllers in the history of controllers, possibly in the history of any kind of engineering ever, actually.
Well, the Jaguar tried to bring it back. So.
They did. They actually made a controller that was somehow worse.
But I've got another NES one, which sort of ticks some of the boxes here. Licensed game is Goonies 2. So this was a Konami, obviously there wasn't a film Goonies 2, but, you know, it was a sequel to a Goonies game that they made.
Well, the history is, I believe Nintendo made the original Goonies game for arcade. It was like on a PlayChoice 10. And then there was a Famicom version, but it never came out to NES in the West.
Yeah.
And then I guess Konami made Goonies 2. Which did come out.
So Goonies 2, again, it's what I've only got because my NES broke and all that. I've never been able to go back to it, so it's why it'd be cool. Like, all my other consoles are hooked up to my TV now. I don't really need to wish to be able to replay them. So it's always going to be NES stuff for me. But it's kind of like a Metroidvania, as I recall, like you're exploring around, but then you find like these rooms or caves and things where it turns into like an adventure game style. Like you've got a static screen and you've got to prod around everywhere to try and find some clue or something. So it was really confusing, like all those kinds of games were. On NES, you know, like the text was probably inadequate and it was a hell of a thing to figure out what you were supposed to be doing or where you're supposed to be going. But for those kind of, you could call them like proto-Metroidvanias, you know, they hadn't really got to that fully developed point yet, but yeah, they were trying and it was ambitious for an 8-bit game. I would kind of like to go back and see just how far short they fell of that, really. It'd be interesting.
I'm guessing pretty far if I had
to. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, the first game was actually done by Konami, but it was only released over here in the arcade.
I'm thinking of a lot of, my heyday was sort of Super Nintendo, and a lot of the RPGs that I really liked that I rented, because I hardly ever got new games, even, you know, all the Mega Man X games, I never owned any of them until years later, so I didn't have the money to buy a lot of Super Nintendo games, so I rented everything, and there were a bunch of them that I rented that I loved, and I wish I could go back and play them now, because that's a lot of that NX stuff, but even outside of that, there's a lot of weird stuff like, you guys ever played Claymates?
I've seen it, I haven't played it.
No.
It's kind of pre-rendered stuff like Donkey Kong Country or Clay Fighter. It was from the company that made Clay Fighter,
okay.
Except it's actually good. Because Clay Fighter is a bad Street Fighter clone. Claymates is actually really good. It's this platformer where you play as a boy who's turned into a blob of clay. And I think his name is Clay, actually. And he goes through all these different levels. And he can transform into different animals made of clay. So you can turn into like a squirrel or a bird or, you know, all this different stuff. And each one has different powers. And it's like very fast paced. And then there's this Super Mario World looking map screen between levels. And every time you beat a level, you have a chance to play Pachinko with him in his blobular form. And that was the first time I'd ever seen Pachinko. And you actually have more control over it than you do in real Pachinko. So it's actually kind of a game.
So it's where the mafia would cut your hands off, basically.
Yeah.
Because you're cheating.
You're technically not playing for money, but you take all the little silver balls and you take them outside onto the street. There's a guy there and he pays you for them because apparently he thinks they're valuable.
That way it's not gambling, essentially.
Yeah, it's kind of like going to Chuck E. Cheese and taking all of your little paper tickets outside to sell them for drugs. If you can imagine. No, it is this fun kind of interactive version of Pachinko. So it's more like pinball. And anyway, it's just a really cool game. And actually, on that note, this is really pretty obscure, but there's a game for Super Nintendo called Smart Ball that is a very interesting platformer where you play as this slime, basically this blob of slime. And he can stick to walls, he can stretch upward to go into certain cracks and things, and he can flatten down, which is how you attack enemies, and you can also go into different places with that. It's a very interesting game because you're messing around with physics and the way the levels are put together, and I don't think that game's ever coming back out. I've actually been thinking about this a lot because I played stuff like Zexus and Crystalis back at PAX East, and I'm looking into buying like one of those Retro Duo machines once I get a job, because there's a few things like that that I feel pretty confident are never... It'll be a long time if they're ever re-released, and so the cartridges themselves are probably not that hard to come by. In the age of the internet, you can find the games that you want, and you can probably find them for a decent price.
It really depends on the game, obviously.
Well, if they're domestic releases, they're probably not that bad. I think a lot of times Japanese stuff is more difficult and more expensive to get.
There's about a handful of games for the NES and the SNES domestically that are ridiculous, but the rest are all pretty reasonable.
And, you know, in terms of maybe things that I would love to get localized that never will, we should mention maybe Mother 0 or Mother 1 and Mother 3.
Well, technically, Mother 1 was localized and just never released.
Yeah, it was. It was done.
I think there's services where you can actually pay someone to burn that ROM to a cartridge for you.
Nice.
So you can play it on your NES. But yeah, I mean, stuff like that would be great. That seems very unlikely
if you're going to go that kind of pie in the sky, I would like to... I mean, they could just release the near-finished Star Fox 2 ROM.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think you really want to play that. I mean, from everything Dylan Cuthbert said...
I've seen, like, videos of almost the whole game I would like to play.
It works. I've played it. The ROM's out there. It can be played.
You think it would be worthwhile?
It was kind of fun.
Command obviously has a lot of similarities if you played the DS one.
It borrows from that game, yeah.
Yeah, it's a Command borrows from 2, but 2 in a way is more complicated because you've got a similar thing of like you've got this overworld map of the galaxy and you're kind of moving positions between different places on it and things. But when you actually get into these, you've got all range mode bits like
right.
Command. But when you get into them, you can transform into a walker and like mess around on the ground and all that. You know, it's nowhere near as basic as
right.
the Command stuff is in the all rage mode, where it's just like you're in a 360 environment, there's a bunch of enemies, shoot them for a while. It does actually look more involved than that.
It's between Star Fox and Star Fox 64. I mean, it lives in this middle ground where they took ideas from it and said,
it introduces the Star Wolf team.
Yeah.
That would be an amazing bonus for the 3DS remake of 64.
Or do, like, because obviously there's no FX chip games on the Virtual Console. At this point, that seems like something that we can write off, like Rare games and, you know, every licensed games and all the things we've talked about so far. So I think, you know, to kind of go to the other part of the question of where might we see them show up, I think FX games, we've got a very legitimate chance of seeing them as 3D classics on the eShop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The original Star Fox, Yoshi's Island, they've already shown it. So, you know, you could also have Stunt Race FX, and you could have Star Fox 2. I mean, it is done. It's finished. It's a game.
Right. I mean, I think there's some issues with the ROM that's out there, but the fan patches have A, translated it, and B, fixed them.
Well, and also, if you have, like I said, if it's 3D classics, if it's not a virtual console game,
right.
they could do some things to it to, you know, make sure it's completely compliant with whatever standards
right,
they
right.
have.
Make sure it doesn't go, eek!
Yeah.
But I mean, there's some stuff in this game that's actually really cool, and it actually looks a lot better than its predecessor. Because Star
yeah,
Fox,
oh yeah,
now,
they definitely made some upgrades.
It was Super FX 2, right?
Yeah, I guess it was the second version of the chip.
The game is done enough that it got rated by the ESRB. I mean,
Well, it was done. They ended up canning it because they wanted to kind of keep N64 being 3D as a sort of very separate special
right.
province that wasn't allowed on Super Nintendo anymore.
The English ROMs never leaked. Only the Japanese ROMs, and there's a few different ROMs of it that have leaked, different versions, but. It introduces a lot of the characters talking stuff that doesn't really happen until 64.
And it also had two-player, I think, or at
I
least
it
was
it
going
did.
To at one point. Maybe that got cut out even before the whole thing got cancelled,
right.
but it was going to have, you know, a deathmatch, dogfight kind of deal with, like, extra Star Fox team members, like, well, not like a serval.
Yeah.
Which is a very, if you don't know what a serval is, it's a very adorable wildcat with massive ears.
It's kind of fox-like.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, they added two things to it. The other one was like a poodle or something. Yeah, Faye. I think her name was Faye. I think she was a poodle. Oh, it's, I mean, it's, if you are interested, if you enjoy the Star Fox franchise, you really should go try to hunt that.
It's very interesting, and that definitely is one of these things that, you know, you want to talk about abandonware. I mean, they made it, then they abandoned it and said,
they literally abandoned it.
Thanks for making that game, but actually we think from a PR point of view, we don't want it to impinge on N64, so.
Right, I mean, it was so dumb, but they did it.
We'll just harvest it for our Star Fox game that we're making for N64, and you could sod off.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Argonaut, you know, go back to Dylan Cuthbert, they made the original Star Fox, Star Fox 2, but it was EAD that did Star Fox 64.
And they stole everything.
I feel dumb that I've never even watched a video of Star Fox 2.
Oh, you go on YouTube, Hall Games there, you can see people play through the entire thing.
Anyway, I think that game could be resurrected one day.
I'm not counting on it, but it would be nice.
Yeah, I kind of, in a way, like Command just felt like their way of doing that. That might be as close as we ever get.
Mm-hmm. Right. I have only one game, and I had to really just scrape my memory to come up with this one. And it's a Capcom game from maybe 90 on the NES called Little Nemo Dream Master.
Oh, yeah.
Which I believe is a licensed game.
It is licensed on a French comic.
I remember playing it as a child. Like, this game's kind of hard. But I actually, you know, I've mentioned on the show before that I'll enjoy watching people play games in like chats now, and the people will just yell at them and make commentary on how they're playing. I think it's hilarious. And somebody played this game one time. Holy crap. Like, this game is like a Coke dream. It is whacked and difficult. And we're never going to see this game again. But I remember it being really fun.
I've played a lot of Little Nemo back in the day, and it's awesome.
It's another kind of sector of Capcom's wealth of excellent licensed games. I pretty much didn't get to touch any of them. I didn't become a Capcom fan until subsequent generations that I would love to play that, you know, ain't gonna happen, is it?
Yeah, another really obscure platformer is called Street Fighter 2010 The Final Fight.
No.
Oh, yeah.
But it has nothing to do with either franchise.
Not really.
It's a straight-up platformer. And it's I think, is it out on VC? I think it might be.
No.
No, God, no.
It's not.
I think you ostensibly play as Ken, don't you?
Yeah.
Yes. But it's Ken in the future.
It's kind of Bionic Commando-ish, but you don't have like a grappling hook, but it's...
I think there's an angry video game nerd about that, which kind of tells you what kind of game it is.
Yeah.
By the way, I don't remember any of the things that happened in that game happening in 2010.
Yeah.
I don't remember Robo Ken fighting giant robo purple monsters while flying dinosaurs attacked him.
No, it hasn't happened yet.
It looks a little like Shatterhand. I think Shatterhand's a better game, though.
Shatterhand
is a game I would love to have some kind of re-release. I don't know what's up with that. It's really good.
To all our aspiring media producers out there, when you make a game or a movie or a book and put a year on it, don't put that year 10 to 20 years in the future.
Yeah, it always cracks me up.
Sooner than you think.
Because if he's fighting robots with psionic powers, it ain't going to happen.
You've got to admit, Capcom has done a better job, you know, in other areas with Mega Man, because they just put X.
They just gave up. Like,
20XX.
Actually, I remember from just seeing it in the past, the Street Fighter 2010 box art, which is amazing.
Yep.
Actually has a big banner on it that says free Mega Man stickers inside. That's probably a bad sign.
To just to mention something quickly that's not on a Nintendo system, but I would love to play Panzer Dragoon Saga sometime. That's a game that's pretty much unemulatable.
Yeah, well, everything on the Sega Saturn is kind of unemulatable.
Well, Radiant Silver Gun's being remade.
Yeah, I mean, they're literally remaking.
That's what I would love to see is Panzer Dragoon Saga just remade from scratch.
There was like a PlayStation version of Radiant Silvergun that got cancelled, so I think they'd already
taken it
outside of the confines of the Saturn. But I played the original Panzer Dragoon on a friend's Saturn and really enjoyed it, as you might expect.
Oh, see, you knew someone who got fooled into buying a Saturn?
Well, Orta is worth tracking down. If you're a Star Fox fan, Panzer Dragoon Orta is easy to play. I think you can maybe even buy it online through your 360.
Maybe.
But if not, it's definitely backwards compatible, and it's easy to find a copy of it. And that's a very good, very beautiful, hard game. And it plays exactly like Star Fox. Exactly. It has a dumb story, but...
But then again, Star Fox doesn't exactly have a Pulitzer Prize material.
No, but it's, Star Fox is more charming, I think. But
Uncle Andros! Yeah, it's wonderfully charming.
All right. Let's move on.
All right, Jeff from Katy, Texas writes, I sat down with the manual for my 3DS and started reading through it, and I came across a little bit of information that I don't think has been discussed yet. It states specifically that while future 3DS software and virtual console titles will be launchable directly from the SD card, DSiWare will not be. I don't remember reading about how much internal storage the 3DS actually has, but it appears that the days of quote-unquote cleaning the fridge aren't quite over yet for those of us who own more than a handful of DSiWare titles. Now, considering how Nintendo's not changing the way the system accesses DSiWare titles, I'm starting to wonder how they're going to handle future sales of DSiWare. We know that they're doing away with the Nintendo Points system for a more direct currency approach for 3DS-specific software sales, but I highly doubt they're going to change all of the price points for DSiWare over to this system. But now, this creates even more problems. Will there be two separate shops on the 3DS? Number one, a 3DS VC shop which uses currency rates. Number two, in the old clunky DSiWare shop which uses currency. If that's the case, will any Nintendo points you have left over on your DSi transfer to the 3DS? What are your thoughts on this?
Buy everything you want on your DSi and then transfer it over.
Or not, if you want them in the original resolution.
Yeah, that's true. I mean,
that's as we raised that last week, you know, you might prefer to keep
your... The specter of terrible-looking games.
It's not even the look, it's if it uses a touchscreen a lot.
Yeah, I mean, if it uses a touchscreen a lot, then you're not going to want to do the mini mode.
Right.
That's going to make it impossible.
It's going to require too much precision.
Then there's a lot of dead zone around the edge that doesn't do anything when you touch it.
So yeah, there might be a number of reasons why you prefer to not transfer things over, provided, of course, that your plan hasn't been to trade away your DSi for the money because you need the money, which may well be the case for a number of people because, you know, 3DS isn't cheap. But obviously, the first thing to say is Nintendo hasn't told us. Yep. You know, you might think that the shop would already be there and we'd already know everything, but they...
You'd be wrong.
But I really don't think they're going to have two different currency systems on the shop. They're going to convert all the old DSiWare titles to money.
I would like to say that, but...
They are.
Also, what's not clear here, to me anyway, is that we're talking about this sort of separation in terms of how games are executed from the 3DS. Now, this may apply only to ones that have been transferred from one system to another, rather than ones that are it's an old DSiWare game, but you bought it from the eShop, may execute like everything else you buy from the eShop.
That's interesting.
That could be the difference, because obviously this whole transfer thing is a bit sketchy. You know, there's kind of like a workaround that they've had to make to bridge the gap between the way that everything was just tied to the system on DSiWare to this new system they've got with 3DS, with the eShop, and everything's on the SD card now and all that. So it may just be for those that you have this restriction, and therefore when you buy something new, you know, even if it's DSiWare, if you buy something new on the eShop, it's like everything else. I would kind of hope it's that way, at least.
Yeah, me too. We really don't know, though. I mean, it's kind of a big mystery.
But it definitely would not, you know, going back to Johnny's point, I mean, it definitely would not be becoming of their pledges to overhaul their online shop and improve the interface and user friendliness and everything about it to have this partition.
But see, I wouldn't be surprised if they do sort of put everything that was DSiWare into its own section of the shop that just lives.
Well, a section of the shop, but I mean, when you're talking about a different currency, I mean, that's a separate shop.
It's a duty-free store.
If you've got if you've got different money, it's kind of like a different country.
Yeah, they're going to have everything converted to the same currency system on the eShop. Now, I do not think you'll be able to transfer your Nintendo points over to the...
Yeah, there's no way in hell you're going to be able to transfer your currency. Because right now...
If you have $100 worth of DSi points...
You're fucked.
What is wrong with you? And go ahead and spend them indiscriminately on your DSi, because there's no way you're going to get to move that shit over.
You are now, going
I mean, the
to
thing
be-
is, to spend it on the games, and then you can transfer the games over. But they're not going to let you convert your currency. That's like taking like a bucket full of arcade tokens back to the counter and saying, can I get my money back for these? No. No, you may not.
I think it's just the natural result of negative real interest rates.
Yeah, there you go. So how Nintendo works, their completely jacked system is you buy Nintendo points and then convert them to whatever currency you want.
Wii or DSi points, yeah.
So, actually, it's Wii points or Nintendo DSi. You have to put the Nintendo on the front of the DS. But Wii is not Nintendo Wii. It's just Wii.
So if I can divert the conversation for a minute. Speaking of, you know, we were talking about how Nintendo is just... The eShop is supposed to be out in like 2 months. Less than 2 months, actually. Like 6 to 7 weeks from now.
Yeah, they've targeted, I think, the end of May.
End of May, right. Late May. And we still don't know all the stuff about it. Nintendo's not saying anything. And the thing is, right now, ever since the 3DS came out, Nintendo really hasn't said anything about anything.
Well, they haven't really done anything. I mean, they haven't released sales figures
for 3DS.
Well, they said it was the fastest selling.
They put out the standard press release every company puts out when they launch a game system.
The fastest selling thing was a corporate response when people were asking about the black screen of death.
Yeah, which only really tells you that it sold faster than the DS and, you know, that sort of thing, which is not like a huge, because the DS, you might think of it as this juggernaut now, but when it was coming out, you know, it didn't necessarily have like overwhelming hype or, you know, really strong launch lineup or any of that stuff.
Right. Spider-Man was the best launch game. I mean,
it was kind of being overhyped by the PSP at that point.
Yeah. It was overshadowed, yeah. But, I mean, look, the NPDs are not far away, so we'll find out what it sold.
Yeah.
In those.
Now, in Japan, it actually sold, I think it sold 800,000.
Yep.
Yeah, in Japan, I mean, you get figures every week. In fact, it got sold by the PSP this week.
Right.
Yeah, and then in the UK, I think it sold its first
113,000 was, the first 2 days, which was, again, faster than the DS. But they say it was not as much as the PSP, but the PSP's figure applies to 4 days. It was 180,000 in four days.
Yeah, how did that work, Greg? Is that like some... Did it come out over some holiday weekend, specific holiday weekend?
I'm not sure, but it's not really comparing like with like... But again, I mean, it's not earth-shattering sales. So it doesn't really surprise me that it's not earth-shattering.
Right. I mean, it's $250.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
Yeah, that thing costs almost twice what the original DS did, so it's doing fine. Anyway, the reason I bring this up is because we're recording this on April 7th, so we are now into Q2, and Nintendo has not sent out their customary quarterly release schedule.
Yeah, they haven't.
Which I thought, I was looking for that on Monday morning.
In Europe, it's weird because there's been a bit of creep with this. Like, the tradition 2 years ago was that once you got to, say, March, then you would have the at least provisional schedule for Q2, so the next quarter. Once you got to the final month of one quarter, they put out the schedule for the next quarter. But now it seems like we get to the very end of the first month of the actual quarter, and then they publish a schedule which includes things that have already come out. Yeah. It's just been getting gradually later and later.
I've also noticed that Europe recently is sending out more individual game press releases with release dates.
There's Steel Diver, for instance.
Yeah. The comically delayed release date for that game. And that got its own...
But to some extent, they have to do that because they've never put out a quarterly release schedule with that on it.
Right. So you would think... I mean, that's the kind of thing that traditionally would be on the quarterly release schedule.
Mm-hmm.
I can only imagine that some of this, in this particular case, just getting away from the European specificity here, is that there may be such a number of things in flux with 3DS in terms of, okay, they're kind of haggling with publishers and all this goes, right, this goes here, this goes there, that they just haven't been able to lock it down until we're in it.
Yeah. No, you're probably right. But the interesting thing to me is that right now, Nintendo does not have a single Wii game on the calendar in America. Not one. The last one that came out was Mario Sports Mix 2 months ago this day on February 7th. And the last one before that was Mario All-Stars on December 17th. So you want to know why I think Super Wii is coming out sooner than later? It's because of this. There are no Wii games this year announced. Now, I know Zelda's probably coming out at the end of the year.
I meant to say, it was a 50-50
Dragon Quest
on Zelda.
Is supposedly coming out, I think, next year?
Yeah.
Dragon Quest X?
Look, I'm not saying there won't be any Wii games at E3, but there probably won't be a Wii game in April. There wasn't one in March. There probably won't be one in May either. There might not be one in June. It's fucking bad. It's bad, okay?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, in Europe, you had Kirby, who was bumped, so that padded out the first quarter a little bit. But, right now, if you're looking at something coming out of Wii, obviously you've got Conduit threatening to come out eventually. You can't really decide when it's going to come out, but...
This is like 2001 N64 releases.
I mean, but, right now, it seems like, you know, the only hope for the Wii in the second quarter, anyway, or before E3... is Xenoblade. You know, that's the only thing we know about that's coming Europe. Like, you know, if they just say, okay, we said it was coming, and then, you know, a few weeks from now they say, and it's coming out in June.
I could see that. I mean, I would love that. I would be overjoyed to have Xenoblade.
See, I'm curious if they're almost planning on getting, like, having some sort of press event queued up.
There will be one before E3, like in May, probably. But they're not going to announce games at that. They're going to announce games at E3. So it's like, what the hell are they going to show at a press event?
I guess,
in May?
Mean, there is the Pandora's Tower thing that we're learning about now.
Yeah.
That's coming out in May in Japan.
Yeah, that's basically like, hey guys, and here it is.
I suppose this is something somewhat symptomatic of just the way Nintendo does things now with the way they handle information, is that they tend to play it pretty close to the vest for as long as they can. With the eShop, though, I mean, you have to say some of it is just it's not done. Because if it were done, it would be on the system already.
Right.
So, you know, there's a legitimate case to make, at least until very recently, that they haven't known what they're going to do with some of this stuff.
I think Kohler had I believe he had a really telling statement in his write-up of the Pandora's Tower video that we got, where basically he said, this is what we know about the game now that we're just finding out now, and the game comes out in 20 days, because only Nintendo could get away with this crap.
Mm-hmm. That's end of May, so it's pretty much, I think it should be right around the time the eShop goes out, actually, when that goes out in Japan. But it was mentioned before.
But I mean, but the fact that all we knew about the game was, here's a picture of a woman's back.
Yeah, sort of Order of Ecclesia-ish tattooed back. But what it looks to be is a character action game, you know, like Devil May Cry or all that, but using the pointer.
Yes. This is our Project Hammer.
The pointer use is definitely distinct in my mind from what was going on in Project Hammer.
Anyway, Greg has the next letter.
Mike writes, so a few weeks ago you talked wrestling on the podcast, mostly older games. I am still a wrestling fan at 26. I like the action, not the soap opera aspect, so the games are great. With that in mind, how do you think they will do a wrestling game on 3DS? Would it use 3D or any new features of the handheld? And would it be good? No wrestling games on Nintendo have been good till the Wii came along.
N64. Super Nintendo and NES too.
Yeah, all of the Aki games.
Maybe, I don't know how old Mike is, maybe he missed out on all that stuff.
You don't? There's a clue in the list.
He tells you, yes, there's 26. A number.
Yeah. 26, you should have been playing, maybe he means they kind of skipped over, there were some wrestling games on GameCube, I mean, I went to press events for them, they didn't turn out to be all that great.
What was a press event for a wrestling game like?
Awesome, brother!
It was actually the first time I ever went to New York City.
Yeah, this is the Smash Brothers story.
Yeah. So it was for WrestleMania, and they were showing whatever that game was called. They had made it specifically for GameCube. It was separate from the other versions.
That's always a red flag, usually.
It didn't turn out to be very good, unfortunately.
I was hoping a press event for a wrestling-based game would be much more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there certainly haven't been very many... He even says, till the Wii came along. I'm not really sure that there are that many great wrestling games on the Wii until maybe just the brand new one, the All-Stars game that Andy reviewed. He really likes that. So.
Yeah, he just reviewed that. Yeah, that's supposed to be
pretty good. That sounds good. But the SmackDown versus Raw games for Wii, I don't think they're meant to be all that great, but I haven't played them personally.
But I mean, yeah, the ones that we talked about were fantastic, the N64 ones.
Well, that's the thing. One thing that was interesting about wrestling, I said I didn't play them. But one thing I found interesting about the wrestling game kind of scene on the N64, how popular it was the fact, of course, N64, you know, you had Smash Brothers that came along in 99, but fighting games, it was pretty much just desolate.
Those were the fighting games.
Because you had Killer Instinct Gold, I guess, early on, and there was Mortal Kombat Trilogy or something. I can't remember. There's some Mortal Kombat version.
There was Mortal Kombat Mythology Sub-Zero as well.
That is something
terrible.
Else entirely.
There's a turn button to turn the way you're facing. in that game.
But, you know, whether it was, you know, the kind of stuff that you had a lot on Saturn, like the Street Fighter Alphas and the Darkstalkers and all that kind of stuff, your 2D games, or whether it was like Tekken or Virtua Fighter, the N64 didn't have really either of that strand of fighting game well represented on it. But yeah, wrestling games were really big. Is there something about the gameplay styles and the controls that really made them work a lot better?
They were 3D games. You played them with the joystick primarily. Well, actually, no. You played them with the D-pad, and you reached down to use the joystick for taunts and finishers. You just kind of... It was one of those games where you just flick it in any direction, you know? So right. You're holding it on the outside, and then you just reach down and flick the joystick to do something special.
Yep.
Yeah, you played those with the D-pad, but they were 3D games. I mean, there were similar games on PlayStation that were bad. On N64, they just worked better.
So I guess in that case, the fact that the 3DS has the circle pad and stuff is not really that big of a deal for recreating the gameplay styles of Z64
no.
games or anything.
No, not at all.
I wouldn't say so, but I would love for those to come back on any system.
John likes to play games about greased up men holding each other.
Of course, I mean...
The muscular, the better, right, John?
But in general, 3DS, very much unlike the N64, seems like it's going to be filled with fighting games. With Street Fighter being one of your flagship yes. launch titles, you've got Blaze Blue, DOA, both coming. It was going to be any shortage of fighting games in general. So I don't know if that's like a good thing or a bad thing for wrestling games. Like, will they get crowded out by more traditional fighting games, or will it just prove that people can enjoy that sort of thing?
I think they'll be okay as long as they stay unique and don't try to actually be like a fighting game. That's the thing. That's what made those Aki games so good, is that they weren't like a Street Fighter game. They were very tactical, but you know, the controls were really good.
They're slow paced.
Yeah, it was very slow paced. Much, you know, it wasn't trying to be a fighting game.
It was
game,
the speed
really.
Of pro wrestling on TV.
Yeah,
the guys are kind of stalking around each other, and then they approach, and that doesn't work, so they back up again, and they approach again, they grapple, and one of them gains the upper hand. It really,
and then you pay $60 to watch the rest of it.
It captured that feel perfectly.
Yep.
Unfortunately, the way I mean, there are wrestling games on PSP. I think there are a couple on DS. I know there's a Fire Pro Wrestling that was kind of an early DS game, I want to say. Fire Pro is still around. They're making that one for Xbox Live Arcade with avatars. So
yeah, I haven't heard much about that lately. But
Fire Pro, though, is probably not what you're thinking of. And that's a very technical, kind of weird Japanese-style wrestling game.
It's, yeah, very much
it's
for...
It's very different.
...for wrestling purists, if you could call them that. It's an interesting question, though. I mean, how could you change a wrestling... Like, what could 3D add to a wrestling game that wouldn't be just... completely stupid, like having somebody being thrown towards the screen or something like that.
I mean, the thing about Street Fighter is that is a 2D game. It's played on a 2D plane, and you can move the camera around wherever you want to. Those characters are on a line facing each other. They're never not facing each other.
Yeah.
Whereas the wrestling games, they are 3D games. You move around in an arena. So I think because of that, and the camera tends to be elevated more, I think the 3D effect would be nice. Also, you've got sort of the ropes between you and the characters, so that's a very easy visual separation there that could be really nice. There's a lot that you could do with the 3D effect that would look cool. It's not going to change how you play it, but it would look cool. And I think the circle pad would be a nice advantage over that, you know.
Well, over the D-pad, certainly.
Yeah, and you probably wouldn't want to play a wrestling game with a touchscreen. So I could see that working really well, actually. It's just the problem is THQ's management of this license has, I think it's still fairly successful. It's become much less appealing to me over the years because they published all those great games for N64, and then EA took over the license briefly, and they made, I don't know, Backstage Assault and crap like that. They made like a couple.
Backstage? Are you fucking serious?
Yeah, I'm serious. They made a couple of pretty bad clones. And then THQ got it back, and that's when they started doing all the SmackDown versus Raw stuff with Yuke's. And they never did bring Aki back to make the new ones. And, I mean, there is SmackDown vs. Raw for PSP, which is just a clone of the console game. You know, it doesn't really take advantage of the PSP in any way. That's I can see them doing that for 3DS, but I don't think it's really going to be special. It's going to be like Madden for 3DS. Like, it is a Madden game that you can play on your 3DS in 3D, but it's not, like, going to take advantage of the system's features very
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? You know, it's wrestling is this kind of weird place between fighting and sports games, and yeah. sports games on portables have had a pretty rotten time of it.
Yeah.
So that's the dark fate you wouldn't want to see experience.
I don't really think THQ is going to go all out and do like a really special 3DS version of it. But I think there will be if you like the SmackDown versus Raw series, I think you will probably get that on 3DS next year. That'll happen. Because why not? Let's move on. All right, our final email is from Wyatt in New Hampshire, and he writes, I wasn't planning on picking up any of the launch games with my 3DS purchase because, as you guys have discussed, there were not really any compelling titles at launch. But when Amazon gave a $25 credit for a launch title, I ended up buying Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon Shadow Wars. I was skeptical as I'd never played a Ghost Recon game, and the only Tom Clancy's game I'd ever played was Splinter Cell Conviction.
Clancy's.
Which I had issues with, but reviews were pretty strong, and people were saying it played like Advance Wars / Fire Emblem, with the latter being a game I love. I'm surprised James didn't get it, as it seems like something right up his alley. I've really enjoyed it so far, but the game is frozen on me and faded to black during the 8 hours I've played. I don't mean the error message people have been getting. It almost looked like a cutscene was about to happen, like you'd see in other games, except it stayed dark. Others have reported the same problems, even in other Ubisoft games. This is the first time I've ever experienced this with a handheld game. Do you think it will be patched, and what is the likelihood we'll see future 3DS games have updates?
Well, you know, in terms of the whole fade to black thing, in the game's defense, it is called Shadow Wars.
Jesus,
so, right, those are the levels that you have to play with the display turned off.
That's
and
right.
And the sound, and everything. So,
Sound Voyager.
To answer the confusion as to why I didn't get this game. I didn't get this game because our own Neil Ronahan had noted that he in his I think I might have noted it in his Twitter feed that the game kept freaking freezing on him as his review copy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I love this game, but this is like the 18th time you've frozen on me.
It does
Stop
sound
it.
Like a really good game. Would be one of the other ones I'd be very interested in picking up if
so
I had
this
the
is
system.
One of those this is one of those situations where when you're reviewing a game you have to say, all right, how bad does this pretty glaring flaw break the game?
Yeah.
And for me, it crosses that line where I'm like, I'm really interested in that game. I mean, it looks pretty primitive and visually it should look better than it does, mm-hmm. but it should also not freeze all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bad enough bug to make you not want to buy it. I mean, what does that tell you?
It tells me that Ubisoft should be looking at the possibility of patching this.
And if they can't patch it, doing what other companies have done and doing a recall. Because, I mean, when your game freezes, and enough that it's widely reported, that's mm-hmm. just bad on you.
It is.
I mean, that's not like a small bug slipping out the door. That's something your testing should have caught and should have stopped the game from being released.
Yeah.
I'm shocked to hear that this is a problem across their 3DS lineup.
I haven't noticed it in Rayman, but if it faded to black, I probably would bump up the review score, so maybe I just didn't notice.
The only thing I can think of is maybe they were testing the game on older hardware than what actually shipped with the 3DS.
Ubisoft's a big company, though.
Yeah, I don't know how that could happen, but or maybe it's some sort of firmware issue where they were testing on a firmware version that was, you know, a little bit behind what actually went out with the 3DS.
Maybe, but that would indicate they must have gone off the reservation when they started coding it. I mean,
well,
they probably would have had to go out into crazy space. And
my
stuff
guess is they just were rushing to get out 5 games for the launch, and they didn't take the time to thoroughly test these games.
That's probably, and it may well be they released it knowing it had this issue, and they just said, "Well, but we have to have that anyway." So
yeah,
what it
gave the Ed Norton Fight Club speech and said, "The good news is 3DS on a technical level, 3DS should be capable of patches." The question is whether Nintendo will allow that, but given that Call of Duty Black Ops has a patch available on the Wii Shop channel,
yes,
I think this is probably doable.
Now, the patch would probably have to stay pretty small because mm-hmm. of the size limitations we're talking about here. Obviously, you can have multiple SD cards, but that SD card needs to always be in the slot while you're playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
But similarly, the game would have to know to look for it. So if Ubisoft didn't put any code in there to go see, hey, is there a patch on the SD card? Yeah, we're probably screwed.
Yeah.
Because if it's not there, they can't go retroactively put it there.
Yep.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing.
So, I mean, Call of Duty for Black Ops, they must have put a piece of code out there that said, hey, go check to make sure you don't have a patch on this hardware.
Yeah, and I mean, with such an online leverage game and everything, you know, right, I mean, I'm sure that was probably pretty predictable eventuality.
They were prepared to do that, yeah.
Yeah, so if Ubisoft didn't prepare to do it, I mean, the only thing they could really do to fix the game is a recall.
And reprint it, then.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah. Nintendo's done this with their games in the past, and Namco did it with Tales
even stuff that's not bugs, like there's the changes in Ocarina.
Or the, yeah, blood the, and the was it Guitar Hero 3 that on the Wii you could only play it in mono?
Yes.
And everybody had to mail in their disc?
That was an actual... That's the only game recall I've ever actually done myself.
That was classic.
Yeah, like... And like I said, Namco Bandai did it with that Tails game that came out on Wii that didn't make it to Japan because it was just broken. Actually, it was broken like this. It froze. And it would freeze like every 8 hours. It'd lock up almost predictably. And they basically swapped out a million discs with another million discs.
Its problem is, though, that sort of thing, I suppose, is more problematic and, well, really just more costly and therefore less likely to happen in the case of something like 3DS with those game cards. It's a lot more cost-effective to reprint DVDs or whatever for Guitar Hero or anything like that because they're just so much cheaper to manufacture. So,
yeah.
You know, you'd think it'd have to take a lot of pressure for them to actually do a recall or reprint of the game.
Mm-hmm. It's upsetting because I was interested in this game, even though when I saw images of it, I thought, that looks like a freaking GBA game.
Well, I assume for a lot of people, this sort of thing would definitely make them more likely to investigate it when it drops in price. You know, that's
right.
Very, very often, you know, if something presents itself for whatever reason as something of a sort of risky proposition,
yeah,
far I mean, more willing to make that leap if it's, you know, lower cost of entry.
So, like, I had Ruse freeze on me and I finally beat the last mission the other day, I mean, after a bajillion tries, and I didn't have to redo anything because I hit a checkpoint, but I had to rewatch a video, and that was enough to be, I had to restart the Xbox, go in, and then watch the same stupid video again, and then issue that same last command. Coincidentally, that's also an Ubisoft game. That was enough to be irritating. I can't imagine what it does if it makes you replay levels, because that would be really frustrating.
Yeah, you can imagine if Fire Emblem froze or crashed and
set a building on fire.
You'd be pissed. Very pissed.
So I would hope that they can fix this game, because like I said, I was interested in it until Neil's travel logs of crashes, and then seeing other people basically report the same issue, it's a little upsetting.
I kind of doubt that they will bother doing a patch, even if they technically could, which they probably could. I don't think Ubisoft will
care.
Go through the rigmarole to actually do that. I do think they might fix the problem in future printings of the game, which would be interesting because if we could ever verify that, and if you had good confidence that you were getting a newly printed copy of the game, it might be worth picking up in 6 months.
It was like buying an Xbox when they put out the new processors every so often. You were like, is this one of the new ones or is this one of the old ones?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky proposition because the serial numbers on games aren't always easy to see. And in some cases, I think they're actually internal, so you might not be able to tell anyway. Actually, no, it should be on the back of your box and on the game cart on the little metal slots, the contact points.
There's an implied philosophical argument here about whether patches are okay for console and handheld games. And a lot of people feel like patches on home systems are kind of a fiasco. I mean, they shouldn't be allowed. And I think that's presuming that there was some kind of golden time back in the old days of console games and handheld games where games never shipped with bugs because they were properly tested 100% of the time.
Yeah.
Which has never been true. So I'm all for patches. As long as they're not really intrusive, you know, as long as they're small and they're easy to apply, I think it's great that you can actually fix these problems. It's much better than living with the problem.
Here's the difference, though. The reason people say that is because they feel like game publishers have become over-reliant on patches and are willfully shipping games that need to be patched just in order to make a deadline.
But
and
they're also shipping games that are about 1,000 times more complex than anything that was done back in the golden days.
Yeah, it's a lot more feasible to test something exhaustive. Obviously, game companies themselves have become bigger and they have bigger budgets for all this sort of stuff.
Right.
But still.
I'm of the mind that if you know there are bugs in the game, you should not go to printing.
Yeah.
Period. Even if you're going to miss the date.
And that's really kind of up to the platform holders for the most part. Because, I mean, in the old days, you know, PC games were rife with problems when they shipped, partly because there is no platform holder for PC games.
In the old days.
Yeah, and even now, the Elemental game.
There we go.
Like
well, the thing is now, I mean, every console is designed from the ground up in order to be able to download patches, firmware, right?
Yeah.
Everything, you can update the firmware. So, you know, you're never going to get around this because by the very design of these consoles now, anybody that makes a game now has a way to patch it. And of course, they're going to use that opportunity to patch it.
Yeah, although firmware updates are different than game patches because
the
3DS already has a new firmware, but that's new.
Yeah, but you can still do that with the console. The console is made from the ground up to download stuff
from a philosophical standpoint, I'm of the mind, and I've had this conversation with people before, we as reviewers should always review the game unpatched because we don't know that the people who have it are going to be able to get the patch. Mm-hmm. And even if it's a day zero patch, we should review it as is without any sort of patching on there and let the chips fall where they may. Because ultimately, if you release a game that has bugs in it and somebody doesn't have their particular game console hooked up to the internet,
then they're not reading your review.
Well, that's not necessarily
true.
There's
like what some differences with whether your system is. I mean, like 360 didn't even have wireless, right?
Yeah.
Not built in, no. You had to buy an extra expensive piece of kit to do it. I mean, the Wii doesn't have wired. You have to buy an adapter. It's not perfect. So it frustrates me when a company releases a game knowing there's bugs in it. Mm-hmm. You should delay, period. Even if you've already printed copies of the game, you should delay.
But if your consoles aren't connected to the internet, especially a PlayStation and 360, but Wii too, you're really not playing games the modern way. I mean, patches are one thing. There's a lot of other stuff going on too. Firmware updates. I mean, if your Wii wasn't connected to the internet, you wouldn't have the SD card channel. Of course, you wouldn't need it because you wouldn't be downloading Virtual Console and WiiWare games.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone who has a Wii that's not hooked up to the internet, at least occasionally.
Well, there are people out there who will not have their system hooked up to the internet. I mean, that's just reality. And if you release a game that is broken because you say, well, we'll just patch it on day zero, you are not serving those customers.
Well, you're serving them a broken game.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm of the mind that a review should reflect that.
Yeah, I mean, tweaks are one thing. I mean, if you want to, like, muck with the controls or some silly thing like that.
Or like, balancing and stuff. But
yeah.
If the game is broken,
yeah.
It shouldn't be released.
Absolutely
I think
not.
I think a reviewer should review the game experience that the reviewer had, which you're going to want it to be the best that it can be. So if there's a patch available, you're going to get the patch because you can, because it's there. You should get it.
See, then you should have to say, this is the patched version of the game that they say fixes this, or something to that extent.
If you're an offline gamer, I think you should have to go to, like, a special website.
Are you suggesting a gulag for offline gamers?
I'm saying you should go to a website that specializes in unpatched game reviews because you're crazy.
Well, I suppose more appropriately, a magazine.
Yeah, because those are done before the game comes out. Hey, problem solved. Go get a game magazine. There you go.
If there are any left where you are.
Okay, that's the final email. Thank you, everybody who wrote in. Great emails this week. And it's time to wrap up the show. Before we go, a few things to note. There's a new episode of Radio Trivia. They're up to episode 90. I can't believe there's 90
wow.
episodes of that show. And they never expire. They never go out of style. You could go back and listen to the very first one. And Neil is on the newest episode, and I'll break a game for you. They kick off with, because you'll recognize it faster than Neil does, when you hear it anyway, they play The Legend of Zelda 3, A Link to the Past, which has great music. And TYP even says, without realizing it, Zelda 3 on that episode. Yes, and I noticed. I
can't believe that hadn't been used.
Exactly.
The last time I was on, the last time I was on Radio Trivia, which is more than a year ago now, it was the first time you guys were at PAX. I did a big audit of everything that had been used, so I could think about the games that I liked that hadn't been on there. But I should have had a link to the path back then, and then that was a year ago, and it still hadn't been used. So
I'm trying to think how I didn't catch that one.
Well, you know, The Big Lebowski's not out on Blu-ray. So
nah.
It's just one of those things.
It's just, I guess it is. Also, if you're looking at the list, the master list of all the games TYP's
ever used,
but there's loads with The Legend of Zelda. So I guess it's easy to just assume.
Eyes just glaze over.
It's easy to just assume, because, like, you know, Ocarina, Majora, Oracle. Oracle's one of the first games that was ever used. I think it might have been in the pilot episode, Oracle of Seasons. You know, like, they've pretty much all been used, but this hadn't.
It's crazy. So, yeah, definitely go check that out. It's really good. And Neil will also be on the new newscast, which will go up the same weekend as this show, so go check that out. There's a new episode of the Famicast, which you probably already heard. If you subscribe to the show, you should have received it automatically. If you download these a la carte, then make sure that you go check that out. The Famicast's shaping up to be a really nice show, and I hope it will continue on a regular basis. Of course, next week we'll have our feature discussion of Legend of the Mystical Ninja, the Super Nintendo game for Retroactive. So if you would like to play along, we really encourage you to do so. It's 800 points on the Wii Shop channel. It's available around the world, very easy to find. It's a really, really good game, very interesting, and there's a pretty good discussion already kicking off in the forums. So if you are playing along or if you've played it in the past, we would love to get your input. Go to the forum thread, post your thoughts there. We have been posting our thoughts as well, trying to get the discussion going. So I want that to be active and interesting for this next Retroactive. And finally, the email address for this show is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com.
That kiss off, son.
Please send in your emails. We really love getting them, and they are a building block of this podcast. So thanks, everybody. rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We'll see you at the Backstage Assault.
I think that's got to be the episode title. Backstage Assault.
Backstage Assault. That's awful.
Yep.
Okay.
It's funny on YouTube. If you look up that game up, the first thing that comes up is headlined Backstage Assault equals worst wrestling game ever.
Is
that's
very
the first
bad.
That, so somebody captured some probably some terrible thing from that game, and it's headline worst wrestling game ever.
I'm not even sure
ever.
If you can fight in a ring in that game in the Squared Circle. I think
backstage.
you can only fight backstage.
That's right. Yeah. Oh god.
It's all back in the dressing rooms and. Why is this so funny to Greg?
Because it's so stupid. It's so dumb.
Hadouken!
I've got the plot here for this game, and I just need to read the first couple sentences because it's fucked. This is for Street Fighter 2010, The Final Fight. The player takes control of Ken, a retired martial artist turned scientist who has artificially enhanced his body with cybernetic implants known as bionics.
Wow, Ken's smart.
The objective of each stage is to destroy a designated enemy target shown before the stage begins and obtain energy required to open a trans-dimensional portal to the next stage.
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit.
I'll buy that.
Soryuken!
So, like, my wave bird eats rechargeable batteries, which I'm kind of surprised by. Maybe it's because I leave it on by accident because the stupid thing won't turn itself off.
Oh, I love tuning that in. I never understood sometimes why what had worked consistently for months suddenly just wouldn't
just
work
suddenly
anymore.
Channel 15's not yours anymore. You got to figure this shit out. So I actually ran into that where I was using channel 15 and suddenly, no, you're not. You're on channel 9 now, brother. I had to keep flipping through channels, and finally I found one that worked. I'm like, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, the WaveBird has its issues, but you have to remember that was the first ever first-party wireless controller.
And it was the first wireless controller that didn't suck.
And it worked amazingly well.
Yeah.
Once you got it dialed into the right channel and everything, it just worked, and it felt great. And yeah, it was a big deal when it first came out.
Yeah.
You can see all about that on our Planet GameCube E3 2002 DVD, which a few of you have from PAX East.
I lost mine because I gave it away as a prize. That's the kind of giving person I am.
You're a saint, James.
Yeah, so there was a game
Train
we were
yourself
talking about.
To let go of everything you fear to lose, James.
Oh, yeah, this is the Macho Man, Randy Savage, yeah.